as I have for the last two or three weeks, I think the first words out of my mouth were, I'm busy right now. For two or three weeks running, I've said that to Marco, even though every single time I've been doing nothing important.
I mean, one could argue that most of what we do is not that important.
That's also true.
Being busy doesn't mean you're doing important things. It just means you're doing something.
Well, that's also fair.
Tired.
Your meeting's from 8 to 5, too.
I was working.
This is a meeting of one.
Actually, it was two most of the time. I was teaching Tiff how to edit podcasts today.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. I don't know, Instagram or... I don't know, she posted a picture of it.
Yeah, yeah, stories. I still don't know what I should be posting on my Instagram stories. I don't think I've ever posted anything on there, and I don't really know why.
I've never done anything. I don't see why I would.
Right, that's a thing. And, like, I want to be the kind of person who just has always done that and does it routinely, but I'm not. And to transition from not having ever done that to doing it, I don't really know how to do that.
Why do you want to be the person who does that routinely? Why? Like, why do you aspire to that? What is it about that person that you would like to be?
That's a good question. Maybe, I mean, it seems like the way you're supposed to use Instagram now.
Maybe. I mean, like, there's stories up top, but there's, you know, square inch-wise, there's way more pictures as I scroll through the terrible application.
Whoa, slow down. What's wrong with Instagram?
Oh, the application? It doesn't give me a chronological timeline that keeps track of where I was. It never has.
You know, that used to really grind my gears real bad until the genius, so genius I should have thought of it myself, but didn't, You're All Caught Up, which I agree with you, John. I would prefer the chronological timeline. I'm not trying to deny that in any way, shape, or form. But I feel like, and what did I hear this on? Independence with Jelly and Alisao and Curtis Herbert. I think it was Curtis who was making this pitch that once we got the You're All Caught Up, that was sufficient.
I said, no, it's still stupid.
I mean, Instagram was never good for completionists, like, because back in the day, it would just lose your place and it would scroll you to the top, like, if you left the app for 10 seconds. So it was always hard for completion. It's actually easier, because if you keep visiting the app, eventually you will be all caught up, even though it won't be in order. Because when you know, if you scroll through a few things now and then you quit the app and you go back a little bit later, you see different things on top, and they aren't necessarily newer, they're just different from what you saw before, and eventually you are caught up. It's harder to see things like in exactly the right way you wanted to. But it's actually, I am now sold on the algorithmic timeline, even though I also hated it at first, because it just changed the way I had to browse.
You're sold on it? I feel like it's reading it like reading a book and going, I'm going to read from the back of chapter 5 to the middle of chapter 5, and then I'm going to put the book down, and I'm going to pick it up, I'm going to read from the back of chapter 8 to the middle of chapter 8, and then I'm going to put it down, and I'm going to go, and then being excited by the fact that, oh, the book lets me know when I've actually read all the pages. Like, screw you. Not how I want to interface with it.
What's nice is that if you don't have time to fully catch up, you can at least be relatively sure that you're going to see, like, your wife's posts and, like, your best friends. Like, you can be relatively sure it's going to show you the things that you want to see, and you will be caught up on those.
Briefly, like, I had that experience today. I saw some of my wife's Instagram posts, and what I did was I went to go post a picture of it to one of our Slacks, because I wanted to talk to Stephen Hackett about it, because my wife and he were in the same location, it seemed. And I briefly left to go to Slack to post a picture. When I came back to Instagram, where the hell's my wife's picture? I hadn't paged through all of them horizontally, because it's the multiple things. So I had to go find her picture by scrolling down the stupid algorithmic timeline, all the while convincing the application that I'm looking at these images. But I'm not, because I just want to get back to the image that I was on before, so I can swipe through. I hate it so much. And there's no iPad app. I mentioned there's no iPad app. I'm not sure if that whole iPad thing's going to catch on, but as far as Instagram's concerned, it is not a going concern.
Yeah, that to me is the more egregious thing. Like, if I had to pick, either give me an iPad app or give me back a straight timeline option, I would easily pick the iPad app, because, like, the iPad is so good for browsing and content consumption. Yes, I know you can work
on
it.
Who wants to see pictures on a big color screen? That's so stupid.
But it's so good for browsing through stuff like that. I don't understand why they haven't done that yet.
So I derailed the conversation. Marco, you were starting to say that you want to be a cool kid. If we're taking the definition of cool kid, which is probably under debate, but if we're taking the definition to be somebody posts to Instagram stories or Insta stories, you want to be one of those people, but don't feel like you have a way in. And let me give you some really good advice. The way in is to just do it and not care.
because I guess that's how people do this, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I've been watching Mike be more prolific, and we've talked about this on Analog. I've watched Mike be more prolific with his Insta stories, and been jealous of it for reasons I can't put my finger on. It just and I think this is kind of true for you. It just feels like something that I should be taking part in.
I can't believe you two have this feeling. I have the opposite feeling. Every time I see someone's story, I'm like, and this is why I never do that.
I just sent a horrible picture of my microphone right now to my Instagram story. I don't know what I'm supposed to do about that.
Accidental live picture. Put on some pants.
Oh, my gosh.
I think if you're going to really build a following on Instagram, you have to participate in stories. But I think it's also like one thought I've had about Instagram recently is maybe I don't need to care about building a following there. Like I care on Twitter because it's so tied in with like promoting my business stuff. But it's kind of hard to promote audio on Instagram or to promote apps on Instagram. Like you can do it, but it's not very effective. Like it's not really made for that.
You should pay Casey to use your app on one of his stories.
And so I'll be an influencer.
Just casually, like, oh yeah, I'm just listening to some look ahead limiters here. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. No,
I am happy to be an influencer, a hashtag influencer on Insta.
Influencer? Is that how you say that? Influencer. But like, I wonder, like, there's almost a level, I know this is like the biggest first world problem in the universe, but like there's always a level of like, I don't have a big following there. And so I feel like it's actually a little more relaxing to be there, that I'm not a super Instagram pro. And so I kind of want to keep it that way. Like it's nice to have an outlet there that is under a lot less scrutiny than whatever I would post on Twitter.
How do you, isn't there a way to like retweet or like reblog, if you will, somebody's story? I could swear there's a way to do this.
Yeah, there is. You can add something to your story and then it puts like in that frame where it like insets.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah. How the hell do you do that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how to do anything with stories. I just view stories.
That's Tiff. She's good at stories.
Yeah. It's funny. Like occasionally, like when Tiff was building Adam's Halloween costume over the last week or so, occasionally she would ask me to like hold her phone and shoot a little video segment on her story of her doing something, and she would have to explain every little detail of how to do this because it was just baffling to me. Like, how, what? Like, I hold this down and then I
again,
push
maybe,
what?
Maybe we should get Adam to do it next time.
Yeah, it's bizarre when you're not accustomed to it.
She needs a helper who understands computers.
This is how old I am. I am now looking at a Wired post from March of this year, actually the day after my birthday.
You Googled it?
No. Well, somebody in the chat room pasted it, but I am old enough that I'm like, oh, this is wonderful. This is exactly what I need. The rules of regramming, which presumably, oh, how to regram. There you go. Yada, 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 yada. You copy a link to the Instagram photo you want to repost, but I don't want to do that. I want to do it somebody's story.
Yeah.
Man, I'm so old.
I'll tell you what, though. Like, here's something that it's a thought I've had over the last few months that I know no one else is going to agree with. I think retweeting ruined Twitter. I think the retweeting is the reason why it's so easy for hate to spread. I mean, there are other things that they should be doing to cut down on that, like basic community management and basic rule enforcement that they seem to not be able to do. But retweeting is what makes Twitter so horrible to be on when you express any kind of opinion, because when people follow you and they see your posts, they get to know you, they get to see things in context, and they get to see you more as a person, so they're less likely to just lash out and attack you. What gets the most hate is when something you post gets retweeted to someone else's audience who doesn't know you, who is less inclined to see the whole round person that you are, and is more inclined to see this one isolated thought as something they should lash out at, especially somebody who has their own, like, you know, angry army of people who like go to battle for them. So like retweeting, seeing someone else's post on timelines of people who don't know them at all, while it might spread, you know, users more easily or might spread content more easily, it also is responsible for those people who get retweeted getting all sorts of waves of trash responses and abuse responses. And back before Twitter had retweeting, you could do it, but it was harder, and it was so basically fewer people did it, and responses wouldn't always go to the person depending on how you did it. And so there was a lot less, you would see a lot less of that trash. But now it's so easy to see all these different thoughts totally out of context and to not even see them as people, or to not know the people, that you get waves of hate just being spread like wildfire all over the platform. And so Instagram does not have native reposting, retweeting, whatever it would be. Like, they don't have that. And I kind of like that. Like, I mean, I guess they kind of have it in stories maybe, but for the actual pictures, like, they don't have that. And so something I post, not only is it easier to see me as a human because it's a picture and not like, you know, a thought, because humans don't deal well with other people's thoughts. But if you see a picture of something nice, you know, that's harder to throw trash at. But it's also because whatever I post is only really being seen by people who have chosen to follow me. And the vast majority of them have followed me for more than just this one post. Like, so they kind of have an idea of who I am, and they see me as a human, so they're more likely to be decent to me. Whereas on Twitter, you don't have that. You when you see something that's retweeted or reposted, you are seeing that totally out of context, and you don't know the person, and you're less inclined to treat them like a person. So I really hope Instagram never adds native reposting.
You know, I mostly agree with you, but S. Harding, or Sharding in the chat room, man, that's really unfortunate. Anyway, has the following to say.
There's a D in there.
Yeah. It's not Sharting, it's Sharding. I generally agree with what Marco was saying, but on the other hand, a lot of interesting people I follow I have found because someone else I respect retweeted them. And I do think that that's a good point. I almost wonder if, like, instead of a quote tweet, instead of a retweet, a quote tweet would be the only, like, officially blessed thing in this phantom universe where Twitter isn't evil. And I wonder if that would make it better. So there's at least a little more context, although I guess somebody could just be like, LOL, which is super ambiguous. So I just argued my way out of that. Never mind. I got nothing.
Didn't we all use Twitter before retweets? Like, this is not just a theoretical thing. Like, we used it. And that, you know, we saw the origin of retweets with people typing the capital letters RT and then pasting in the content of a tweet and everything. But it was harder, and it did require you to put in more effort, so it was less prevalent. But I felt like it was still possible to discover things because people would do exactly that. They would copy and paste the person or a portion of their thing or whatever. Like, I mean, in some respects, it would be hard to stop retweeting from existing because of that sort of, before there was retweeting, there was the thing that led to retweeting, and people would just continue to do that today. So I'm not sure it would help that much because I feel like the problems are fundamental, but making native support for it certainly let it spread more quickly and makes it much more accessible.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I feel like if they removed native support and you just had to do it the old fashioned way where you type in RT username and then you already have fewer characters, you got to like maybe start editing the tweet to fit, like, people did a lot less of it because it was harder. You know, by making it so easy, by making it like one or two taps to do, it's something that orders of magnitude more people do than if it was still the old hard way where you had to basically copy and paste the tweet. Like, that was harder. And so, like, I really think it was like multiple orders of magnitude less of it happened then and would happen again if it went back to that.
But don't you think that this is somewhat rooted in stuff that you did? Like, didn't this... I could make an argument that this came from reblogging.
It might have. Tumblr had reblogging years before Twitter had retweeting.
Right.
But I don't know if Tumblr inspired. Tumblr also didn't invent it. It was like a term on blogs. Tumblr just made it easy. It was a thing that bloggers would occasionally do before Tumblr. Tumblr made it really super easy to do, and so it exploded in usage. And that had problems too. It didn't have quite the problems of Twitter, in part because, well, at least when I was there, in part because it was just a smaller scale platform than Twitter, but also in part because it was much more about longer form thought and much less focused on the social feed and constant social activity. And it did eventually, it did like over time, it did kind of go closer to that, but it was never to the same level that Twitter was in a lot of these areas. And a lot of that was just due to the format. But, you know, certainly... It was in a similar vein, but nowhere near the level of ease and kind of like the mania and the speed and the mass at which any thought would get huge amounts of trash thrown on it from other people.
So in summary, you should just continue doing Insta stories, and not to put any peer pressure on you, John, but Marco has taken a photograph of his setup and I have of mine. We could go for the trifecta and you could do that right now live on the air.
Seems unlikely. My main objection to all that stuff is I don't want to share more aspects of my life with the public. Like, the amount I share is the amount I want to share. So giving me an outlet to share more aspects of my life is not attractive to me. And I look at Instagram stories. I find that other people do it. I enjoy that, but it's just not something that I want to do. It doesn't matter how much other people do it. It doesn't change my inclination to not do it.
But John, everyone else just jumped off the bridge. Don't you want to? No,
but I don't have that problem. Whatever, the opposite of FOMO. What's that, that thing?
I know FOMO. I don't know what the opposite of it.
No, fear of not missing out. Someone in the chat room get it. There is an actual reverse FOMO.
POMO, proud of missing out.
Actually, that's probably it.
Is that it?
I just made that up. I don't know.
It's probably it. Now, I've found that I've been enjoying contributing Insta stories for things that are not, so I was going to say things that are not mundane, but like me washing my car is mundane. I do that freaking hourly, it seems. Oh, but
if I can, speaking of washing your car and doing things, if I can give you one suggestion as someone who watches all of your Instagram stories, yes. whatever the name of that effect is, where it goes forward, reverse, never do that again.
You're not a boomerang fan, huh?
Nope. You are a boomerang fan. I am not. And by the way, it's JOMO, the joy of missing out. I definitely I'm all in on JOMO, and I am anti-boomerang.
Real-time follow-up. Very important.
Oh, man. I like the boomerang, but you know who else hates the boomerang? Erin. Erin hates the boomerang.
She knows what's best.
The problem with all those built-in effects and the little like sounds they play, like a little like, oh, woo, kind of party music like that, I'm one of them, like whatever that is, they get so overused. Like those have all been there for so long now that they're just old and so played out, and they don't add new ones very frequently. Yeah,
and they never looked or sounded good. They were always hacky, and now they're hacky and played out. But the boomerang, that's not my objection, the fact that it's hacky or played out. I just don't like it. I don't enjoy that effect. I find that upsetting.
Fair enough.
It's on the list of upsetting things.
It is. Like, something about it makes a clip that I might enjoy. Oh, look, there's Casey doing his car. And it's going forward, back, forward. No, stop it. Stop it. And you just want to close the window.
Wait, close the window?
You know what I mean. It's like when we tape things, we all still say tape things. And eventually people will start rolling their eyes at that.
No, but I've enjoyed posting, to finish my thought earlier, posting things that are not mundane, so like not the everyday consistent machinations of my life, but things that are slightly more interesting, I hope, he says with no commitment whatsoever. And I think it's fun. I think it's interesting and neat, and I enjoy watching other people's Insta stories. And I like that Instagram is a two-headed monster. It is both the super curated, look at how perfect my life is, as well as, oh, look at this disaster. This is just kind of what's happening to me today. Haha, who cares? And I like that you can get both of those in one spot. And I've heard a lot of conversation recently. I can't remember where I heard this particular conversation that I'm thinking of, but about how Instagram is maybe it was on RecDiffs, actually. I don't remember now. But Instagram is like, oh, look at my perfect life and everything's perfect. And you should be jealous of how perfect I am and my perfect vacation with my perfect wife and my perfect children and all that. And there's certainly an element of that. But I don't know. I think most of the people I follow on Instagram, even if their timeline is that curated perfect life, which I think I'm fairly guilty of as well, their stories are a little more haphazard and human, which I really enjoy.
We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks bone conduction headphones. Let me tell you, these have ruined me for all other headphone types when I'm out walking around listening to podcasts. Every other headphone now feels like it's keeping my ears too hot and sweaty or pressing too much on them, or I don't like how they block the sound around me because then I can't hear like if a car is coming. Aftershocks avoids all of these problems because they are bone conduction headphones. Here's how this works. Instead of having some kind of like speaker driver that your ear has to hear through the regular ear canal, so like it sticks something in your ear or it squishes against your ear or it goes around your ear, Aftershocks works differently. They have these little transducer pads that rest next to your ear, and they send little vibrations that you can't really feel that your eardrum picks up, so you hear it, but there's nothing on or in your ear. And so not only does it keep your ear from getting sweaty, which is great like for exercise use or for just walking around in the summertime, I love these in the summertime, but also because it isn't blocking up your ear, you can still hear the world around you in addition to the podcast you're listening to in your Aftershocks. And this is great if you're walking or running or biking or doing anything else in the world where you need to, for safety or practicality concerns, it's really nice to hear the world around you. this is what this gives you. I really don't like walking around with headphones that cover up my ears anymore because I miss hearing the ambient environment. I want that. So Aftershocks are great for that. They're also just really good Bluetooth headphones. They are, of course, wireless because they're Bluetooth. They have great battery life, great reception. You can place calls on them and they sound great too. They have a warranty if you need any help, although I don't think you will because they're really nice. And they're also just super small and they weigh nothing. Like they're like, I think they're like less than 1 ounce. Like they weigh nothing. I highly suggest you check them out. Go to atp.aftershocks.com and you can get the Trex Air bundle for $50 off. It's a really good deal with code ATP bundle. So once again, atp.aftershocks.com and you can get $50 off the Trex Air bundle with code ATP bundle. Thank you so much to Aftershocks for making really awesome headphones and for sponsoring our show.
Tell me about your look-ahead limiter. I would give you a standing ovation because I hear good things have happened, but the whole house is asleep, so I'm just going to very quietly say, well done, sir.
Thank you. Yes. So on the last show, I was talking about how I was trying and not very well succeeding to implement a look-ahead limiter for audio processing for part of the upcoming Voice Boost 2 feature of Overcast and other tools that I make. And so I was having lots of trouble last week getting the gain processing to work on my limiter. And I'm happy to say that a few hours after I posted the show, I got it working. And I've been tweaking it and improving it the whole rest of the week. I've ported Smart Speed into this new architecture. And if you're listening to this, you are listening to Voice Boost 2 processed files because I've used it on the tracks for this podcast to normalize the volume and apply my EQs for each of us, each of our individual tracks. So that's one role to use it for me is in podcast pre-production or podcast production, I guess. I also, a big part of designing like a heavy audio processing pipeline intended to run on phones is you have to really think about performance and battery costs to doing this. You have to have something that's really, you know, like well below like 10% CPU usage to, you know, for people to really not notice the battery cost of it. And on my iMac Pro, where I've been doing most of the development, actually all the development until about 2 hours ago, on my iMac Pro, I was able to get this down to using 0.1% of the CPU with real-time playback.
Wow.
But the whole time I'm thinking like, well, this is my iMac, like, when I run this on the phone, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, lower the, you know, it's going to raise these numbers up and I'm going to have to, like, you know, really, really pinch the pennies on that and lower the budget, maybe reduce the quality of some things. I ran it on my iPhone XS and it ran at exactly the same cost as on the iMac Pro.
Wow.
0.1% CPU usage or about 900 times real time. I'm shocked that the iPhone XS runs this stuff, which includes, like, you know, a lot of like bulk math operations, a lot of like vector operations on, as mentioned last time, on large arrays of floats, like huge amounts of number processing here, and the iMac Pro and my iPhone XS run at the same speed, and so I'm very, very happy about that. Not only does that bode well for me being able to ship this with the high quality modes enabled and with some pretty advanced processing, but also that's just awesome. It's an awesome statement about how fast the iPhone XS is. Like, that's pretty amazing. I also, for comparison, ran it on the iPhone 5S, and that runs it at 0.5% CPU usage. So,
my word.
About four times slower, roughly.
But still, you have so much headroom that that's fine.
Exactly. Like, if it can run on a 5S, which is my slowest supported device, using only 0.5% of the CPU, then it's totally fine to ship even the highest quality stuff on the iPhone 5S. So very, very pleased with this.
So we had one listener write in to suggest, I think it was an audio person, I forget, about like using multiple limiters instead of just one, like a cascading series of them culminating in like the hard cutoff limiter just to get rid of, just to make sure everything's within the envelope, but basically a series of limiters, you know, starting with a very gentle one and then whatever. There's this whole theory behind it. Did you read that? Did you take any of that advice? Was it helpful?
I did read that. That was one of a handful of really great emails that we got from really great people, and I thank them all for that. I haven't had time to respond to all of them yet, but I'm very, very thankful for those emails because they were really good. And that so when you're producing like a music album, you do much more sophisticated processing than what I'm doing here because you have different needs. Like what I'm doing here is trying to maximize the perceived volume of speech in talk podcasts. And that's very, very different from trying to master a rock album or something. One of the things, so one of the reasons you'd use multiple limiters is, you know, I mentioned last time the whole deal with being a look ahead limiter, where as the volume of something is approaching the clipping point, you want to start reducing the gain on it before it clips, so that way it doesn't hit that clip and sound bad. And the look ahead part, it can make that perfect. It can make it such that you look ahead of where you are by enough time that the time that you're applying the reduction is going to be less than that. So you look ahead by like 5 milliseconds, and you can apply the reduction over 2 milliseconds. So you know if you can see 5 milliseconds ahead and you can see that you're about to clip 5 milliseconds from now, you can, over the next 2 milliseconds, apply that reduction gracefully. And then by the time that peak signal comes in, you're low enough that it doesn't clip. The problem is that if you take that method for all of your volume reductions, you kind of cut off or tame or like diffuse what are called transients. So like the hit of a drum, you get like this nice smack, like this nice big hit. Whatever your average like loudness level is, you want those quick little transients to actually be louder than that. You want those to be able to break through that wall, not to clip, but if you're having a lower limit of like your target loudness than the actual clipping threshold, you want those transients to be able to get through, because otherwise everything just sounds kind of flat and muffled. So when you're doing pro mastering, you do stuff like that where you have some limiters that will let things through that don't look ahead. So they will let through quick sounds and then reduce their volume over like, you know, a few milliseconds after that. This is what compressors do too. This is kind of what the point. And so the idea there is you can let those quick transients through, but still maintain the kind of average loudness within the desired range. So you need that for like kind of loud music production, but then you still need another limiter at the very end of the chain to make sure, even despite that nothing is going to clip. So usually you'll have one or two limiters or compressors earlier on in the process to help shape that volume, but still allow transient loudness things through. And then at the end of the chain, you'll have a look-ahead limiter that can do a perfect job of making sure nothing ever clips. But ideally, very few things are even approaching where that limiter is set. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of these, you know, audio engineers who are actually pros at this, unlike me, have been writing it to tell me. And that's really nice to know. But in the case of a podcast app, I'm not going to use that kind of complex setup because I'm not trying to preserve those transients. Like when somebody smacks their lips together on a podcast, like I don't need to let that through louder than everything else.
You need to let that file system bell ring.
All right. Anything else on your look ahead limiter? All snark aside, I'm very excited for you. That's really awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very like, this is just one of those times where like I'm doing hard stuff and it's working, and it's like that's such a satisfying thing for a programmer. Like you don't get a lot of times like that. Like so much of what I do is just like BS moving stuff around or laying out forms. And like this is so much better, and I'm so happy. So yeah, I'm having a really good week.
Awesome, John. Tell us about iOS and swapping.
One thing we forgot to mention last week, we were talking about Photoshop on iOS and how to deal with the fact that iOS doesn't support swap and, you know, files take up a lot of memory and all that other stuff is one aspect of using your disk for memory in a situation where you're going to be using it a lot is that you may wear the SSD faster than you normally would. Now, this is true of the SSDs in our Macs because all our Macs have swap. It's true of our hard drives. So if you ever ran Mac OS X in the early days, you saw how it massively abused your hard drive, especially if you didn't have too much RAM, pulling things off the disk and into RAM and out of RAM and onto the disk. But given SSDs being what they are and they have a particular wear life, it's potentially putting more wear on a phone a phone's flash storage than would happen in normal usage, because I would imagine that most iOS applications do not deal in the huge amount of memories that potentially Photoshop could be subjected to, because they don't have a built-in swapping system to deal with it. So I don't think this is a real concern, because again, Mac apps do it all the time, but it is probably something that Adobe has to think about and that Apple has to think about, and that hopefully will not have any unpleasant surprises about. but I meant to mention last time we did. Oh, and this and the second item of this is that while this was being discussed on Twitter, a couple of people suggested, I think Steve Trout and Smith was one of them, that Swap is surely coming to iOS devices eventually. I think they were basically making an infinite timeline argument to saying, well, like, look, you know, the reasons for not having it were because you could barely get, you know, an OS X derivative to run on a phone at all. And any kind of lag or anything related to swapping would have killed the experience. And that's all still mostly true. But today's iPhones have way more memory, way faster flash, way faster CPUs, way faster GPUs. At a certain point, there is no reason not to have swap on an iOS device. Other, you know, like that you can add it without impacting user experience. We're probably not exactly there at this point, but eventually, like whether it's swap traditionally or a unified memory architecture where disk and RAM are the same thing or any sort of, you know, very future world things, like this is not the steady state forever where Macs have it and iOS devices don't. Eventually, the, you know, like I said, whether it's a unified memory architecture or some swap like usage, it's probably in the future. Not this year, not next year, within 10 years, conceivable.
See, I disagree that it's an improvement overall. Like iOS has benefited greatly from the architecture of not having swap because both the system and the apps are forced to manage their memory in some way. Like they're like on desktop OSs with swap, you can grab as much memory as you want and the system will figure out a way to give it to you. And there's all sorts of optimizations, but the reality is like if you write bad code on the desktop, you don't get punished for it nearly as much. Whereas on iOS, if you write code that takes too much memory, your app gets killed. Like, and so you don't do that and you have to think about it and you have to be conscious of it. If iOS gained swap, you wouldn't have that so much anymore. You know, if your app just slows down a little bit over time, you as a developer might not feel that so much, or you might not care about that so much. It's very different if your app just gets killed because it used too much memory. If it just kind of slows down, it's going to be hard for you or your company to prioritize fixing that. So that what you're going to get is a whole lot of much more bloated, much more sloppily coded apps. And I think iOS as a platform has benefited greatly from that restriction it's had so far, where that's just not really possible.
Well, it's also been hurt by that restriction in that you'll launch a game and it'll kick everything else out of memory and those things have to relaunch from scratch, which takes battery life. And so there's downsides to it as well. But the other thing that's important to remember is that you don't have to have the same rules as on the desktop. You can still have rules about the maximum amount of memory an application can take. Having swap just gives you a little bit more flexibility, right? Maybe it's just the OS that's allowed to use swap, you know, like you can just make the limits a little bit higher. Like, because if you had to think of like, I launched some big application, and I go back to my, you know, web browser because I was doing some research in it because I'm Vitici, I'm on an iPad and I have 12 things open, right? And oh, the web browser got booted out of memory because the application used too much. And I have to wait for that application to relaunch and restore its state, right? That's not a better experience than allowing that application to go to swap and swapping it back in, because presumably swapping it back in is faster than letting the application go through the entire launch procedure again, right? And it doesn't mean that you just
might
have to
not
say,
be.
I definitely will be, because yeah, you're just it's you have to read less from disk and you get right back to the state you were. You don't have to restore that state by executing a bunch of code. It's just pulling stuff in from memory, especially if you dedicate a special pool of slightly faster memory, like your swap disk, right? You can, there's all sorts of things you can do when they control the entire widget inside there to make it, you know, to have a memory hierarchy that is not exactly the same as on the desktop. It's just giving you a little bit more flexibility. So maybe you just raise the RAM ceiling for applications by, you know, some tiny percentage to give a little bit more headroom to make it seem like iOS devices have more RAM than they have. That's the type of thing to think about. Not like it's just a free for all and you just get to like allocate memory until everything slows to a crawl. And even the Mac's not entirely like that. I mean, there are limits, you know, and you'll find out if you ever try to install database software on your Mac exactly what those limits are. The limits do exist. They're just way higher than on the phone. So I think there's a reasonable compromise to be had at some point, and that it would be a benefit.
All right, John, tell me about, and hopefully our editor can put in a little bit of taps or something in the background. Tell me, John, about your last Apple Photos book.
This is it's only memorable for one reason. So I knew we talked about the deadline when Apple was going to stop selling you photo books, and you have to use one of those third party things. And I said, I want to get all my books out of the way so they have a nice match set of books. Like, I know I wanted to, you know, go back all the years I wanted to go back to and print all my books before the deadline. And I did. And they came and they're nice and like got it all done. Right. But right around the time of the deadline, I realized, oh, there's one more book I should make. Like, we did one other trip.
Oh, and no.
I think that's worth making a book. Right. So I did. It was like a San Francisco trip that we did, like unrelated to WWC. We just went to California and did touristy things. Right. I'm like, that was a significant enough trip. I bet I can make a book out of that. And sure enough, I could. I made a book out of it. And it was like, you know, I thought maybe I didn't have enough pictures, but I did. It was fine. And I ordered that book. And I ordered that book on the 30th, like literally the last day you could order the book. So just getting it under the wire. And that book eventually came. And like, I don't know why I had this fear a little bit when I ordered the last batch of books. But I was like, I made it out. Everything's great. I have this beautiful match set of books. I got this book. I looked at it. I'm like, great. This book looks great. I, you know, look through it with the family. Check it out. It's, you know, I did it. I got all the books. And then I went to put it on the shelf and I realized, wait a second. This book didn't come with the big cardboard sleeve that all the other books come in. It's kind of like, what is that called on Blu-rays, where like the Blu-ray slides into like a cardboard thing?
Yeah.
Figure what that's called.
Like a slip cover.
Right. I have the same thing with my Studio Ghibli Blu-rays. Like for the longest time, they would come with those cardboard things, but then they started not. And so now I have, on the ones on my shelf, half of them have the cardboard things and half of them don't. And it's very upsetting to me. Anyway, this book didn't come with the cardboard thing. So I have an entire line of books that are all exactly the same size and shape inside the little cardboard sleeves, and one book that's not.
I'm so sorry.
So my dream of having a completely consistent Apple photo book collection is dashed. And so I also loaded the third-party stuff to see what it's like. The Mimeo one looks okay. I kind of, like, this is sad to say, but, like, I mean, I tried the third-party ones before I knew they were going away, and I didn't like them. They're better now, but honestly, the Apple one, because I'm so familiar with it, it's much faster for me to get the result I want. The new ones have more options, but they're very buggy and weird, and I'm worried about what the things will come out like. And so I'm kind of dreading ordering, like, you know, next summer's Long Island book. But I'm going to do it, and hopefully it will be roughly the same size. You know, there will be a discontinuity, but the discontinuity is kicked off by my last Apple Photos book, which did not come with a cardboard sleeve. And of course, my wife's like, oh, you should email them and call them, tell you to bring your card. You're like, yeah, they're going to be like, this crazy person wants the cardboard sleeve. I'll be, it'll never happen. So I'm resigned to having a one mismatched book, which is going to be the beginning of what will surely be a series of mismatched books as I move away from Apple as a vendor.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, where you can instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. Get a server running in seconds with your choice of Linux distro, resources, and its location. Linode is by far my favorite web host I've ever used. I've been with them long before they were a sponsor. I think I've been with them for about 8 years now, 9 years, something like that. Not only are they a really, really good value, so for example, plans start at just $5 a month. That gets you a 1 gig of RAM plan. And they also have, of course, everything. If that's not enough for you, they have all sorts of bigger plans. I use, for Overcast, I use, I think, about 25 Linode instances right now. And they span the gamut. I think my smallest ones are 2 gigs. Those are $10 a month. And then I go all the way up to, I think my biggest ones are like 64 gigs. And these are all amazing competitive prices compared to anything else I've ever seen in the business. But it's also just a really nice host to use. I love their control panel. I've used a lot of web hosts, and the control panels are usually terrible. But Linode's is really pleasant, really nice, really easy. Their capabilities are really nice. They have, of course, things like backup services. They have built-in load balancers. They have great stats called Longview. If you need any help with any of this, they have 24/7 support. I file tickets here and there. I usually don't need to, but usually when I do, they are really responsive and really helpful. So I just love Linode. And you can see all this yourself because they also have a 7-day money-back guarantee. So there's nothing to lose. And they're hiring. If this is the kind of business you want to be in, go to linode.com/careers. I just love using Linode for all my server needs, and I suggest you do too. You can get a $20 credit when you visit linode.com/ATP and use promo code ATP2018 at checkout. Linode is just my favorite web host. You should really use them if you need a web host. linode.com/ATP for that $20 credit. That could be 4 months on that $5 a month plan. Or use promo code ATP2018. Thank you to Linode for sponsoring our show.
We should talk about the Apple event, but before we do that, we should talk about the iPhone XR, which the reviews have been dropping over the last few days. I actually was a guest on my buddy Tyler Stallman's podcast, and we talked about his experience with the iPhone XR. He got a preview in New York for it because he works on YouTube, and Apple believes that YouTube exists, yet Apple does not believe podcasts exist. Not that I'm bitter. Anyway, we had a really good conversation about it, and I encourage you to check that out if you are at all interested in the iPhone XR. Like I said, Tyler had some time with it. He's a phenomenal photographer, a professional photographer, and had some really interesting thoughts about it. But plenty of other people have had them too. I haven't heard any other talk about it as yet because I'm behind on podcasts, but the rumblings I've heard via Tyler and via texts that I've read is that it's really freaking good, like really, really good, and without too many compromises. And I'm stunned and really excited about this. I think, as many have said, this is probably the most interesting phone, possibly even device, at least up until next week, that Apple's released this year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot to say on it yet because I've never held one or used one or seen one in real life. But all the reviews seem really positive. The summary, if I can, you know, editorialize a little bit, like the summary basically seems to be, I keep looking for ways that this phone is worse and I'm not finding them. Like that's kind of like what everyone's opinion has been. It's it should be worse in more ways than it is, and in some ways it's actually better. Ultimately, I think if I wanted a phone that was a little bit bigger than the 10, and I didn't mind losing the 2x camera, I would probably go for it. Unfortunately, neither of those are true. I really like the 2x camera, and I use it sometimes. Not as much as I thought I would, admittedly, partly because it's such a worse camera in any kind of low light. But I do use it sometimes. And the size is such that I like that you can get the plus screen resolution. I know it's not. I know it's 2x instead of 3x, but like you get the plus point size. So like you get the plus's screen real estate in a phone that is not quite as big as the plus or the max, excuse me. So that's nice. Like I like the potential of having more screen real estate, but without going quite so big on the phone. But ultimately, that losing that camera would hurt. I do think it's really interesting how, you know, I think one of the biggest features that's lacking is 3D touch, but no one seems to care because it turns out not a lot of people use 3D touch that much. And even for the keyboard cursor movement, which a lot of people don't know about, but like that's what I use it mostly for. I've been learning through all these reviews that you can now do that by just holding down on the space bar for a second and then moving your thumb. So like they even kind of fixed that part of 3D touch not being there. So it kind of seems like it's a really good option if you don't mind that camera. And, you know, the major difference is the screen being a different type that is not as good. But even though I love OLED, I love my OLED TV, I do love my OLED iPhone X and XS, I love the OLED watch, I'm a snob, I'm picky. Despite all those things, I could switch back to an LCD phone tomorrow and not even notice. Like, it just doesn't matter that much on your phone. I thought it would matter more than it does. It just doesn't matter that much. And OLED, we also thought, would bring a big battery boost because it should use so much less power. And it turns out it kind of hasn't. Like, the battery life is basically the same as it was. And part of that's because we look at so much bright content, but that isn't changing anytime soon. So, you know, I feel like the 10R has a better price, a better screen size to body size ratio. It has a screen that is supposed to be a lot worse, but kind of isn't. It's like a better battery life. Like, it's a pretty awesome phone. As long as you don't want that 2X camera, it's a pretty awesome phone.
Yeah, it comes in colors. The back doesn't have the ridiculous, like, lozenge of camera array, you know.
I like the lozenge.
I don't
like that it's vertical, but I kind of like the lozenge. Actually, I do like how it looks vertically. I just don't like it underneath my finger. But the little circle. Yeah,
I don't mind the lozenge.
Yeah, I think it actually is a good look. It's just underneath my finger too much. On the screen thing with OLED versus LCD, like, bright content is one problem, but the real problem is that the 10 and the 10S and the 10S Max have true 3X, right? So if you had a true 3X LCD right. and had to crank the backlight to shine enough light through all those stupid transistors, it would not be as good battery life wise. But it's the right compromise for the screen. Like the best analogy, I mean, Gruber came close to it, but he's not as much of a car person as we are. Like, the 10S and the 10S Max are luxury cars. Like the price premium of a luxury car over a less luxurious car, it's never worth how much additional you're paying. Like, how much more expensive is an Audi than a Volkswagen? You don't get that much more value. It's not linear. It's like, if I pay twice as much, the car will be twice as good. No, it will not be twice as good. It'll be better. It'll be 1.25, 1.5, but times as good, but it won't be twice as good, right? So you pay a lot more for the 10S and the 10S Max are phones that are better, but not in proportion to the price. I think the 10R is the type of phone, kind of like I've been saying that they should do with laptops, but that never do. Like, the type of phone that will make people who buy it really, really love Apple and iPhones. Because when they get that phone, it will have the things that it doesn't have, they're unlikely to care about or miss because they don't have anything to compare it to, especially if they're first-time iPhone buyers. And the things that it does well and the things that it does better than anything else are really important. Like, the one I keep coming back to is the best battery life of any iPhone ever made of any size and anything. Like, it's the best battery life. And it's thicker to get best battery life. Nobody cares. Like, it's lighter because of the aluminum, so the thickness doesn't show up in it feeling like a brick, right? Like, it feels less dense than the other phones, which maybe makes it feel less luxurious and expensive, but who cares? It's got a beautiful screen. It gets incredible battery life. It's the size most people want. It comes in fun colors. It's the kind of phone that if someone buys it as their first iPhone, they're going to be like, boy, iPhones are great. Like, this is the best phone I've ever had. Like, it does all the things that I want it to do, and it looks nice, and it's pleasant to use, and it feels good, and the battery lasts all day. And, you know, the price is the magic of anchoring, of like selling it for the same price the most expensive iPhone has been for years and years. It's just that, you know, last year we cranked that up. It's even higher. So now we have this new, again, like luxury car, this new ridiculous tier where you can pay us even more money. And suddenly, like, the regular BMW seems reasonably priced after you've looked at the M's, right? It's like, wow, this is like their bargain BMW. No, the M's are just really expensive. Like, it's the typical, you know, so they're clever with the money. Like, it would be great if this iPhone was more accessible to more people. It's not. It's just, it's a very expensive phone. But I think it is a wonderful balance for most people. And it's like, well, Apple used to say this about the Macs when they were trying to cover their excuses for why their Macs were slower than PCs. They'd be like, it's a well-balanced architecture. Like, we didn't want to have too much of this and too little of that. So everything is kind of evenly balanced. But it's really true in the 10R. It's a nicely balanced phone in terms of, well, one of the balancing things, unfortunately, is making sure Apple continues to make its expected margins, right? So they take out a camera, they take out a gig of RAM because they don't need it, because the scroll back, the graphic buffers are smaller because it's 2X instead of 3X. Like, they didn't have to do that, but they want to maintain their margins, right? But everything they took it out of, it's like JPEG compression or MP3 compression. They took out it in places where people won't notice it and gave it things to recommend it, like the real long battery life and sacrificing thickness that no one will notice. And yeah, in some ways, it makes me wish like the 10S line came in more colors. Maybe it makes me wish that there was a thicker version of the luxury thing. What if I want battery life like that? Can I pay more to get that battery life? No, you can't. You have to pay less to get that battery life. Like, I'll trade the thickness or whatever. So there's still some balancing to be done in the line, but I was going to say, I think this is a great product, very well balanced, and will be very successful, I was about to say. I honestly don't know how it will sell, because I can't tell how skewed Apple's audience or customers are in always being obsessed with buying the best and the most expensive. So maybe we'll never know exactly how well it sells, but I can tell you, if you are in the market for an iPhone at any point until before the next iPhones are released, and you're trying to decide which iPhone is the one you should get, consider the 10R. Don't consider it a lesser phone. Consider it just a different set of trade-offs than the other phones. I don't even consider it lesser. It just, you know, especially because I feel like the battery life is the type of thing that most people would trade for the 2X camera. Why do I need two cameras? I'll take the extra hour of battery life. I'll take it all day long. Oh, and it's the cheaper phone and it comes in colors. It's great. I don't know how many people make that call, but I support that call.
Yeah, I completely agree. I am really interested to see one in person. As I've said many times, I feel like the iPhone X is bigger than I want it to be, but I can't go back to like an SE-sized phone. It's just not going to work. So something even bigger still, I can't imagine I would really care for, but I want to try one out. I want to hold one. I want to play with one for a few minutes and see what I think. So that'll be my homework between now and the next episode, because we certainly won't have anything to talk about next episode. Definitely not an entire event, which is happening, what is it, Tuesday the 30th at 10 in the morning in the one true time zone, which I'm finally really excited about. Mm-hmm. It was funny hearing Jason bemoan having to travel across the country to do something Apple related. Yep, this is how the rest of the world lives.
When we all go to the Apple events?
Well, no, I'm just saying like when we go to WWDC, like we have to cross the country for WWDC every year. But at least it's not in San Francisco anymore, am I right? Anyway.
Well, so we'll all be in the Brooklyn event, right? Because we got our invitations as press.
Oh yeah, totally.
Well, the theater holds 2,000 people. Obviously, we'd be among those 2,000.
There's plenty of room for, I mean, Marco's practically like right there. He could like walk there.
If only. Yeah, if somebody wants to put in a good word.
He's a little late for that.
No, I meant in general, you jerks. But anyway, that's okay. So there's an event. It seems pretty clear that iPads are going to be the stars of the show. What do we think we're going to see? And I can either start throwing ideas at you guys and we can talk about it, or if you just want to do like an overview individually of what you think you're going to see, how would you like to handle it, gentlemen?
Well, I do have an opening statement.
Please.
I'm really excited about this event because
there's a possibility that the word Mac will be mentioned.
Yeah.
A possibility, mind you, not a guarantee.
Right, yeah. But what we've heard, the rumblings we've heard about what is likely to be announced at this event are really exciting things, but we know pretty much nothing about them. So it's actually a really great balance of like what's being spoiled versus what hasn't been spoiled yet. Like what's been spoiled, like for me, there's like these three major themes to me. There is completely redesigned iPads.
And those have basically been spoiled. Like what do we not know about them?
Oh, there's a lot we don't know about them. All we know about the iPads is that they're most likely going to have Face ID. They're most likely going to have, you know, a more edge-to-edge style design. Mm-hmm. And if you believe the like case rumors, then they have a new connector on the back for something, right? A lot of the other stuff that we've heard has been based on really loose speculation or based on software leaks or software spelunking. And so that's things like the Face ID came from that. Things like the USB-C support, that's all just from software spelunking. That could be like, so there's the rumor that like it's going to have USB-C ports because, and possibly only USB-C instead of having Lightning, which I think actually I would support that decision. That's based on software support for outputting video over USB-C that's 4K.
It could just be over a dongle.
Yeah, that could literally just be a new Lightning to USB-C dongle that can output 4K video. So that the fact that that support is there in the software, we don't actually know that the iPad will have USB-C ports based on that. So that's an unknown, like USB-C, huge question mark, who knows, right? And does it get USB-C instead of Lightning or in addition to Lightning? Does it get more than one USB-C port? Those dramatically change, you know, what this product is. And by the way, I think that's a great idea because then not only can you just have one set of dongles, because like, I mean, look, if we're going to live in a dongle world, at least you can reuse them between devices.
they should have two USB-C ports so we can have more than Casey's MacBook.
Oh, that's just brutal. In fact,
even with one, it can have more because you can charge it while you use the USB-C port. If it still had Lightning, I mean.
Yeah. I'm guessing it goes to just one USB-C port and no Lightning.
Agreed.
That's my best guess. But my ideal case would be two USB-Cs and one Lightning, which would really make it like a real power machine. But I don't see that happening.
That would be a MacBook Pro at that point.
But also, like, you know, like when this rumor first started, the one thing I thought was, boy, there's so many like, you know, made for iPhone, made for iPad, you know, the MFI program. There's so many like peripherals that you can plug into the iPad through the Lightning port. And there's like, you know, like there's a lot of audio stuff that you can like audio interface and everything. And they wouldn't want to give that up, right? But then I thought about it some more. I've owned a lot of these Lightning Port peripherals. And first of all, there aren't that many. Many of them never even made the jump from the dock connector. And the ones that exist are mostly garbage. Like, they're really not very good. The most powerful thing you can do with that Lightning port is use that USB adapter with the charging pass through, keep it powered with the charging port, plug it into a powered USB hub, and then plug in real devices. That's like the best thing you can do with that port. If you actually want like hardware devices plugged into your iPad. And so getting rid of the Lightning devices, yeah, people would not be very happy if they owned them because there would be no way to adapt them, as far as I know. So you just lose those if you upgrade your iPad. You just have to throw those away and replace them. So that part kind of sucks. But that ecosystem is not very good. It's just full of mostly crap and not that much of it. So to move the iPad to the USB-C ecosystem opens up such a world of possibility for external device support, even without having a lot of software support on the iPad. Like, just with the built-in, you know, HID profile support that it has for standard things, like standard audio devices, standard input devices, like the built-in support it already has is enough to have a lot of wonderful USB devices be natively supported on that device if it just had the port, and then you wouldn't need all these dongles. And that, I think, would be really, really nice for the platform.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see any chance of it having USB-C and Lightning. I think that, I don't remember which one of you just said it, but I think it would be one USB-C port only.
Yeah, that's the most likely, I think.
But it would be interesting to have Lightning for sure. But I would expect it's going to be, you know, my same MacBook scenario all over again. And I don't necessarily think that's a problem. I think that's just fine.
Well, it's like, we're in that world anyway, right? So like, we might as well at least be able to use these dongles on more than one device.
It'd be great if it had one USB-C port, but no new place to charge the pencil. And the pencil was unchanged. So it's like, you can get a pencil and you can plug it into your iPhone to charge it, or use a dongle to charge it from your iPad. Like, just continuing the trend of the pencil being like the person who, you know, loses the musical chairs and has no place to sit down. Yeah, like, here I am, I'm a pencil. Oh, everything's taken. I guess I'll just be here on the desk. Don't worry, I'm slightly weighted.
Yeah, right.
Oh my God. Yeah, and like, and that's that whole thing, like with having potentially this new connector on the back. What is it for? Huge question mark, right? And then what does that mean for the smart keyboard and the Apple Pencil?
It means Apple gets to sell you a new smart keyboard and Apple Pencil. That's what it means.
Of course. But well, look, they did it every time they changed this. I mean, look, they went from 9.5 or from 9.7 to 10.5, and mm-hmm. I had to get a new smart keyboard. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they're happy to do that. But and that's, you know, that's kind of cost of doing business with this kind of stuff is, you know, you as the buyer, like when you buy a new iPad, you're gonna have to buy new accessories for it. That's just how it goes, and that's how your iPad ends up costing $1,000 somehow.
And this 9.7 size last, well, I mean, them changing the bezels and everything has caused a little bit of a problem, but sizes last usually more than 1 year, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
so it's just the smart connector coming into the mix versus before the smart connector with the Bluetooth keyboards. This has been a little bit variable, but I don't think it's that bad. Honestly, I'd rather have a keyboard that exactly fits than them trying to like maintain compatibility through things. And they should continue to rethink their connector strategies, as we've discussed.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I really want to see what this means. Like, this is why this is exciting to me, because like, we've heard enough that it sounds like this is going to be a really cool iPad update with a bunch of major changes. And I want it, but we don't know what any of them are. Like, and the small rumblings we've heard of the directions they might be in, things like USB-C, things like a new connector and new pencil and probably new keyboard, those are all really exciting because these are all areas that the iPad's been kind of lacking or kind of not great or not as good as it could be. And if Apple has rethought these things at some fundamental level, that's promising. Like, they could just go off the deep end and ship total crap and give us, like, you know, a keyboard that dies with a speck of dust that falls into it. I mean, they would never do that. But, you know, if they did, maybe they'd stick with it for 3 years and just pretend it's fine. But so far, the iPad hasn't had those things. Like, the iPad smart keyboard is fine. It is totally sealed in, so nothing ever gets in those keys. It works very reliably. It feels okay. And it's totally fine. So, like, if you have, like, the A-team and Apple keyboards, working on a new iPad keyboard that possibly connects in a more convenient way, working on a new pencil that possibly connects or charges or whatever in a more convenient way, and maybe working on designing the new iPad to better support the keyboard and pencil, that's really exciting. I want to see what that means. And we have no clue yet. And that's even more exciting.
I'm still fixated on the idea that I put into my own head a couple of shows ago, which I'm assuming there are still no rumors about because I certainly haven't seen them. But I, and maybe no one else in the world, really wants an OLED iPad because I watch a lot of TV shows on my iPad and the blacks suck. So, yeah. Like, I know it's silly. It's like, why you watch? I have a big fancy TV. Like, that's where I watch most of my TV. But sometimes, like, as I've talked about in Rectives, there are iPad shows where it's like, eh, I'm not paying that much attention. It's before I go to bed and I'll watch. I mean, I know people love this show, but The Good Place. It's a short show. It's like 20 minutes or, you know, it's a 30-minute show without commercials or whatever. I watch The Good Place on my iPad most frequently because it's like, oh, before I go to bed, I'll watch one episode. It's short. It's, you know, like, I don't feel like I'm missing anything. It's not like Game of Thrones, like these epic imagery. It's a bunch of people standing around talking. It's a comedy, right? But I would like that to be better. I would love an OLED iPad. I'm assuming because there are no rumors, that's just not in the works, and I kind of understand why, but it would be neat.
I agree it would be really nice, but I don't think it's ready yet. Like, I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah.
Are we seeing Max?
I think we are.
I think we have to. Like, if put it this way, if we don't, it will be very disappointing in a way that I think Apple, if we weren't going to see any Macs, that Apple would strategically leak or otherwise prepare the ground for the idea that there would be no Macs whatsoever. It doesn't mean that the Macs we see will be the Macs that we want, but I feel like if there wasn't going to be any, if the only thing at the event was going to be the iPads, and by the way, I'm assuming we all agree, iPads are like a lock. Right.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Will probably be the focus of the event. And now we're just talking mm-hmm. about, in addition to the iPads, what else might there be?
Yeah. And I think it's going to be limited to, you know, a small number of slides before the real meat of the event. It's going to be like, here's an intro. Look at how great the iPhone is selling. Everyone loves it. Here's some quick updates about the Mac, you know, and it'll be, you know, we've updated the iMac with the new processors that, you know, now it has more cores, et cetera.
Do you think they'd say that on stage?
It might get a quick mention, like, you know, iMacs are updated today with, you know, the latest Intel whatever generation processors, and then and, you know, maybe some other minor thing. And then
you don't think they're gonna put T2s in the 5K iMac?
That's a good question. I would be surprised if any new Mac was shipped that didn't have the T architecture in it. Like, I think they're all gonna have it now because it's such a dramatic improvement for not only SSD performance, and it's such a gain for like manufacturing integration to have that part be one of theirs, but it's also just massive improvements in security of the system. And I don't like the fact that they put it in even the 13-inch MacBook Pro this summer, and not just 15, not just the iMac Pro. Like, there's a reason they're putting it in all their laptops now. I bet we're gonna see all Macs shipping with the T whatever chip by, you know, maybe a year from now when they've all been updated.
That's what we talked about when the iMac Pro came out, that this isn't just a thing they do with the iMac Pro. This is the new way that Apple makes Macs. Like, because we had the T1 before it, but like the T2 was such a dramatic statement of not just like a fancy thing we're doing for our top end computer, but like, this is the new architecture of Macs going forward. Something like this until and unless we do the ARM switch or whatever. But the reason I mentioned it for the 5K iMac is like, if it really is just a speed bump and they just swap the CPUs, it probably wouldn't be mentioned on stage. And it would be a way to say, well, this isn't the new 5K iMac. This is just the old 5K iMac with a more traditional speed bump. So I don't know what the timelines look like on getting the actual new 5K iMac, which will surely have a T something chip in it. I'm just wondering if this one is just going to be like a CPU swap or whatever.
I'm not expecting, as I think you just implied, I'm not expecting an iMac redesign at this event. Also, the iMac just isn't in that much need of a redesign. Like, the bezels are a little wide, but it's fine.
No, an internal redesign, like the next 5K iMac, meaning the next one that has all new internals. Like, as you've mentioned in a couple of past shows, ditch the spinning drive, use a more iMac Pro-like cooling system, but use all the desktop, all the non-Xeon components, and, you know, like, just basically a non-Pro version of the iMac Pro, which doesn't exist. We have the previous generation 5K iMac, and we have the iMac Pro, which represents the next generation. We don't have a non-Pro of that generation. I don't know if that's ready to come yet, so I'm wondering exactly what this 5K iMac will look like inside. Although, honestly, externally, the iMac is probably due for a redesign as well, but if the iMac Pro didn't get it, I'm not holding my breath to see one anytime soon.
I actually don't think that it is a lock that we would hear mentioned on stage, even if there was a slight visual refresh, even if they add the T2 chip. I think that they I think Apple would be willing to do a lot with at most a little hand wavy. Oh, and we've got some new iMacs.
They got to fill time. Like if it's just the iPads, there has to be something else. So what else do we think it's going to be?
I mean,
Mac Mini.
That's honestly, that's the funny thing is that like what's rumored for this event, which is backed up by a little bit more than just wishcasting. Mm-hmm. What's rumored is like, it's like the magical unicorns, things that we've been wanting forever and thought we'd never get, a replacement for the MacBook Air and a new Mac Mini and a new iPad Mini was recently like,
oh,
what?
Stop it.
Where did that come from? Like, so like, and I don't necessarily think we're going to get all those things, but it sure does seem like we are probably going to get at least the MacBook Air replacement and maybe even the Mac Mini. That is amazing to me. And even, I mean, look, Apple over the last few years has shown two different paths they can take when they do massive new products like this. They can make it really suck. That's what the 2014 Mac Mini did. That's what the 2016 MacBook Pro did. And that was probably about it in the suck department. Or they can do something really freaking amazing that shows that they still care and are still capable of greatness, like the iMac Pro. The iMac Pro is awesome. It's so, so good. Still now, I don't know how many months in, I love my iMac Pro so much. I have zero complaints. It is perfect. So we know Apple is capable of greatness still, but we also know that they don't reliably deliver it. So the question is, if we do have a MacBook Air replacement, and if we do have a new Mac Mini, are they good? Or do they make these products even more punitive than they already were? And then leave them that way for 5 years. So I'm guessing, let's start with the Mac Mini, because that's, I think, the lesser known thing. I would be shocked. I think all of us would be shocked just to see a new Mac Mini. It's such a long shot. It's been such a long shot for so long. It's been the butt of jokes. Like whenever anybody's doing event predictions and some listener is like, what about an iPad Mini? And we're like, ha ha ha, that'll never happen, right? The fact that it actually is rumored to happen credibly at this event is shocking and would be amazing if it happens. But there's so many questions. I mean, we covered this a few weeks back, so I'm not going to go into too much, but like, you know, what does it have in it? Does it have, you know, like my theory was that it'll probably be the guts of the new 13-inch MacBook Pro. So it'll have the T2, because I think all new Macs will have the T2. So it'll have a T2. It'll have like the, you know, that 28-watt processor class. You could have, you know, four cores in it again, hopefully. I don't expect them to increase the expendability or upgradability of it from the 2014 model, which is basically none. So I expect it to be totally locked down, everything soldered to the board, including the SSD. I don't expect it to support hard drives at all. There was a rumor a while back that it would be, quote, pro-focused. I think what that means is SSD only, like the laptops, like the iMac Pro. So I'm guessing it is a very small box. Unfortunately, I think it's also going to have way fewer ports, and I consider that a loss, because part of what makes the Mac Mini so versatile for so many different things is that it has a bunch of ports in the back and of all different kinds. And so chances are whatever you need to plug into it, you can probably plug in without a dongle. And I don't think the new one would have that. I think the new one, they would go for making it super, super small, which they don't need to, because no one looks at their Mac Mini and says, boy, I wish this was smaller.
I do. I don't even have a Mac Mini. I think we,
you
we
don't have
to
one.
Find that
no, the people who have them or who want them are like, I just want this thing to be updated, for God's sakes.
It could be a little smaller. We need to find the link to that preview, though, because we did actually cover this really well. And so you should go back and listen to that episode if you haven't. So we'll sound really smart when the Mac Mini comes out, because I think we did cover it really well before.
Yeah. So, but either way, like, I hope they put as many ports as they possibly can fit on the thing. I know they won't, but that makes the current one useful, and it will make the new one useful too. But ultimately, like, anything about this is going to be a pleasant surprise, even if they make it suck even more in some ways, which they probably will. That's been their pattern with the Mac Mini, is like, you know, two steps forward, one step back. So we'll see about that. But the fact that there's going to be a Mac Mini at all that is credibly rumored is really, really promising on some levels.
I think what they should do is come out and announce that they're working on a new Mac Mini to thunderous applause and say, we've listened to Mac Mini owners and we think we know what we want and we're going to give them a new Mac Mini. And then sometime in the middle of next year, say, Mac Mini is not going to be ready in 2019. The new Mac Mini is a 2020 product.
At least it would be something.
Because the Mac Mini people think they've suffered. But there's nothing like the interminable wait after they tell you that they're working on a new Mac Pro to actually getting that Mac Pro. I have to wait until June to even see anything about it, probably.
Well, I was going to ask. So are we going to have even a tip of the hat in the direction of the Mac Pro during this event?
I think it's a perfect time for a trailer.
But I agree. It's a perfect time for a trailer. I don't think we're going to see it.
I don't think there'll be a trailer either. But it feels like June. But you know, I'm not even. You know, go for it. I'll be pleasantly surprised. But I'm mostly thinking about the Mini. I still have trouble believing it, but it's conceivable. The laptop thing, you kept describing it as a MacBook Air replacement. I'm just conceptualizing it as a new laptop that is not one of their existing laptop lines.
Yes.
And but I have no idea what the hell that will mean in terms of like, what does this product mean? And as we said before, I don't even think it means they'll stop selling the friggin' Air, right? But just a new laptop. A new laptop, and a new laptop is a potential vehicle for all our hopes and dreams, because maybe it has an actual different keyboard. Maybe it doesn't. Who knows? But like, a new laptop gives you an opportunity to not just, you know, beg for scraps of modifications to the existing laptops that we have frustrations with, but to say, if it's a new laptop, everything's up for grabs. This could be the new and a whole new line of laptops, like, or it could just be more of the same.
This could be the new direction that all their laptops will be migrated to over the next couple of years. Like, that's what they do. Like, they start with one model. The generation that we see today started in 2015 with the MacBook 12-inch, the MacBook One. Like, it started with that. That showed, like, the new way forward, the new construction style, the new keyboard, all the, you know, some of the, you know, USB-C only, like, all that stuff. They started that in 2015 and then brought it to the rest of the line in 2016. If this is a new style and not just, like, a really cheap cut-down thing, it might be a preview of what we're going to see for the rest of the line. So it is exciting from that point of view. It's also just exciting that even if it is something totally different, which it seems like it probably would. To get out of the way, like, one possibility is it's just a really cut down MacBook Escape. Like, that, it could be that their new low cost laptop is just a really stripped out MacBook Escape. So maybe it has like
same keyboard.
Yeah, it would have the same keyboard. It would have the same case. Maybe it has a crappier screen. Maybe it goes down to one USB-C port, like Case's unfortunate beast of a machine. You know, maybe it goes to, you know, it does wouldn't have a P3 discrete screen. Maybe it wouldn't have, you know, a good processor. You know, who knows? Like, there are ways they could cut it down. You know, they could really cut back the stock hard drive size and RAM and everything else. So, like, there are ways they could cut that machine down to give it a low entry price to get it kind of near where the Air has been. I really hope that's not what they do. I think that's what they were hoping to do when they launched this in 2016. But I think the market has spoken, and the market has said that's not what we want, and that's why the market keeps buying MacBook Airs. Because if you remember, like, even in the 2016 introduction of the new MacBook Pro line, when Phil Schiller introduced the Escape, he mentioned the MacBook Air and basically said something on the lines of, like, he positioned the MacBook Escape as the new MacBook Air replacement. But the market just didn't agree with that and has not, as far as I know, has not really bought them to fill that role. And for lots of good reasons, you know, ports, price, keyboard. Assuming that it's not just a really cut down MacBook Escape, that it's actually a different laptop, it's so exciting because we don't see brand new laptops from Apple very often that are like totally different new styles or new bodies or new generations. So even though it's going to be most likely a low end product, it's still going to be exciting. The 12-inch MacBook is a very low-end product, but people love them and people buy them. Even people who could afford, you know, higher-end models, so many of those people buy the 12-inch one because of its other qualities. So anytime Apple releases a new laptop is exciting, even if you don't think it's going to be the kind you want, because it might be the kind that you end up wanting, or it might be really cool in other ways that you know that you find, you know, useful or nice or pleasant. So I personally am curious about this just to see, number one, like, what do they do with the port situation? And number two, this is really my number one, what do they do with the keyboard? You know, like, that's my huge question. Like, are they going to have the same keyboard, or is it going to be tweaked or different or what? Like, huge question mark for me. But ultimately, I just hope that whatever they do does actually finally replace the MacBook Air. Because the MacBook Air, while it is wonderful, has had the same design and general specs for 8 years. And when it was launched, the 2010 MacBook Air was one of Apple's most successful products in their entire history. This generation of this laptop was flawless. It was perfect. It was improved over the previous generation in every way. There were zero downsides to it. It was affordable. It was fast. It was versatile. It was widely appealed. Like, it was such a good computer for so long. It really does deserve a place in history, in Apple's history, for being so successful. It also deserves to die 8 years later. Like, it's really, it finally needs to die. It needs to be replaced. There is no reason they should still be selling that body style in 2018. There should be a replacement. Apple should do it justice by giving it a really good replacement. And I think they might be about to do that. And that's why I'm excited.
It needs to die, but mine has been killed, which is why I'm actually in the market potentially for whatever new laptop. Because I have.
What happened? Did you lend it to Casey?
Oh,
no, it's a 2011 MacBook Air. Now my children use it. My daughter dropped it, cracked the screen. Like, it is, she beat that thing to hell. The only thing that finally killed it is cracking the screen, because then you get those lovely, like, green and colorful, like, lines of pixels going. You know, it's a mess, but you can actually see physical cracks, and it still works. You can still use it as long as you don't, like, if you can see what the heck you're trying to do. But it's dead, right? So it's been a problem in our house since the school year started, because they have to do homework on the computer, and then they end up using my wife's computer, and then they both need to do homework at the same time. So we basically need, at a minimum, one homework laptop. And I keep rephrasing it as that because I'm going to try to say that you can't use it unless you're doing homework, because honestly, like, they do everything else in their iPads and their phones anyway, right? It's only when they need to, like, use Google Docs with a keyboard, or, you know, my son is taking a programming course in Swift, so... He's taking a programming course in Swift, but, you know, kids these days, right? What does he use to do his programming homework? And it's because they make him do it in the course. He types his Swift code into a giant fancy text box in a web browser on some website that lets you type your Swift code in and run it for you.
Oh, God.
Like, that's, everything is on the web, including programming Swift. Because that's just, I showed him Playgrounds, but he's like, oh, but I don't know how to get it to print something. It just shows me the result on the right-hand side. I'm like, whatever, just go back to what your teacher wants you to do. It's fine. Anyway. We need a homework laptop.
To be so fair, I still stand by the fact that Swift is a terrible learning language and is not at all for beginners.
It is a complicated language, but I think it's reasonable to learn in. Like, because you're not learning all the nuances of Swift. You're just
like, you need a language that's, like, forgiving and nice and friendly. Swift is just such a dick. Like, you can't. It's just, no, I don't.
If you just do the simple things, like, they're just doing, like, conditionals, loops, functions, arrays, strings. It's fine, right? Like, they're not into the parts that are annoying in Swift yet. And, you know, anyway.
Swift is the friend that you kind of fall in friendly love with real hard, right? Like, oh, there's this person that just really gets me, and I love this person. And then after you really, really get to know them, you realize, ooh, yeah, they have some dark spots that I was not prepared for. Now I'm not sure how to...
Swift is the friend that insults you within 5 minutes sitting down at the table for the first time to meet it, and you're like, all right, I'll see you later.
Such a baby.
The only part of the ugliness is coming through a little bit is so much of the standard library deals with optionals, which is a concept that I think beginners shouldn't have to understand.
That's very true.
He's mostly taking it in stride. But anyway, the whole point is we need a homework laptop, so... I'm watching this event. I've been holding off on it and dealing with contention for the computer and all sorts of whining and everything. Because I'm like, just wait, there's an Apple event coming up. And then no matter what happens, if they don't do anything, then we'll buy something. But I really hope they offer a laptop that is cheaper than any of their existing ones that is fine for doing homework on. That's what I want. And I don't want to buy another MacBook Air because, you know, 2011 MacBook Air, if I bought a new one, I'd feel like I was buying another 2011 MacBook Air. I understand I'm not, but the screen is still basically the same. The case is the same. The CPU is faster. The SSD is faster and bigger. But other than that, I don't want to buy another MacBook Air. I want a new laptop. So I am actually watching this event with the intent to spend money. Now, obviously, I'll probably also want a new iPad, and my wife definitely wants a new iPad, but neither one of us needs one, so I'm going to try to hold the line on that. We'll see how it goes.
So you are getting a computer, maybe one or two iPads. Marco, what's your intention sitting here now, not really knowing what's going to happen?
I mean, I use my iPad every day. I'm using it more and more over time, not less. It's a 10.5. So I might rationalize whatever new one comes out. Ultimately, though, my 10.5 is fine, with one exception. The screen coating on this model shows fingerprints like crazy. It always looks horrible. Like, and I've even heard that, like, the more recently produced ones don't have this problem, but mine was, like, one of the first earlier ones. And it, like, no previous iPad and no iPhone I've ever owned has shown fingerprints the way my 10.5-inch iPad Pro does. it looks horrible all of the time, to the point where it actually, like, it actually interferes with content displaying on screen when it's on. Like, you have to, like, constantly be, like, wiping stuff off the screen. It's really gross. And so I would love to replace it just for that. But ultimately, that's a really small reason to replace, like, a $1,000 iPad. So we'll see.
I have seen you use much less to purchase much more.
If the new cheap laptop exists and has a non-butterfly keyboard, I will buy it. I don't care how low end the specs are, I will buy it. That's how much I hate the butterfly keyboard.
I keep hearing butterfly keyboard, and I keep thinking of the 701C. And I know that's not what you mean, but RIP, little buddy. You know, Rifola reminded me of something that I meant to ask you, John. That's an excellent question. So they announce a brand new Mac Mini and an Apple 4K display, or even 5K display. It doesn't really matter, but something that is made by Apple. What are you doing, John?
Nothing. I don't want a Mac Mini.
Okay. I had a feeling.
What do you do with a Mac Mini?
I don't know. Mini things.
No, he needs to hold up some component of my Mac Pro. I want to raise. Can I put it underneath my monitor to raise it up a little bit? Because Apple doesn't make adjustable stands.
Maybe you can put it under a HomePod to keep it from making a ring on the desk.
Yeah, might interfere with the bass.
No, and like I have a Mac Mini for home server stuff, but it's totally fine. Like I don't see any need to replace it until it dies, and it's probably going to be a while.
You know, this is possibly the most ATP episode we've ever recorded. We started out talking about, well, briefly talking about waffle makers, which you may or may not hear in the beginning, but you'll hear at the end, critiquing how all these social networks are from the perspective of old dudes. Then we talked about math and look-ahead limiters. We briefly touched on a brand new iPhone that's never existed before. And then for the iPad event, we decided to talk about Macs instead.
I like to think of it as the Mac event, really. I know it's the iPad event, but as far as I'm concerned, if any mention of Macs is made, it suddenly becomes the Mac event.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, like, we did talk about the iPad a lot also, and I think it's going to be most, like, the iPads are going to be the focus of the event, I think. I do think the Macs are going to be relegated to a brief segment of slides at the beginning of the event, kind of like in, like, the low priority updates, like, hey, we touched the Apple TV, here's an update. Like, it'd be like in that section of the keynote. Right, so it's not going to be like a major thing, but even like right now we have these pretty significant rumored Mac updates. If any of them happen, that's newsworthy. Like if we get the low-end laptop or the Mac Mini, that both of those are newsworthy and awesome, and that we've been waiting for both for a long time. So here we go. I really hope we get them. I'm very excited to see what this event is, and I'm more excited about this event than I've been in a while because of what is rumored, but yet how much we still don't know.
I agree. I get the feeling that this is going to be really, really interesting. And I don't have a lot of specifics, as we've already discussed, but it seems like it's going to be interesting. And I haven't felt that way in a while, I don't think. You know, we all thought the iPhone X was going to be interesting, but we also knew most of what was coming. And I don't get the feeling like I know most of what is about to come. We'll see what ends up actually happening, but it seems, as you've been saying, Marco, over and over again, and I think you're right, that this is kind of up in the air, and that's really exciting.
We are sponsored this week by Warby Parker, who believes your glasses should not cost as much as your phone. They make prescription eyeglasses starting at just $95, including prescription lenses. They believe glasses should be viewed as a fashion accessory, so you should be able to afford maybe more than one pair for different moods or different looks. And for every pair of glasses sold, they also distribute a pair of glasses to someone in need, so you can accessorize and they're doing good for the world on your behalf. They also have sunglasses, even if you don't wear glasses. I don't wear glasses, but I do wear sunglasses, and I recently bought Warby Parker sunglasses. They start at just $95, including polarized lenses, or you can get them with prescription lenses starting at just $175. And all of these, sunglasses and regular eyeglasses, are available through their home try-on program. Here's how this works. They send you, for free, five pairs of glasses of your choice, whatever you want to try. You know, you try them out, see how the frames look on you, see how they fit. They will send you up to five pairs. You try them on for 5 days, and then you send them back with a prepaid return shipping label. none of that is, there's no obligation. You don't have to buy anything. They don't bother you. They don't hassle you. There's no like automatic buy if you don't do something. They send you the try-on kit. You send it back when you're done, and then you can decide whether you want to buy any of them or not. They also have an app to help you out with looks and buying and everything. Their app is super easy to use. And if you have an iPhone 10, you can use the brand new feature called Find Your Fit. This uses the iPhone 10's true depth camera to map and measure your facial features. It's pretty amazing, really. And then it can use those measurements to recommend about 12 frames that are likely to be the best fit for your face. And it only takes a few seconds. So check all of this out today at warbyparker.com/ATP. And you can see for yourself, you can get that home try-on kit. You can try on your glasses up to 5 frames, no obligation, 5 days. Check it out today. Once again, warbyparker.com/ATP to get that home try-on program. Thank you so much to Warby Parker for sponsoring our show.
We got an interesting question from Cameron Deerdorf. Cameron writes, Apple names their chip series with a letter. We have the A series on iOS and other devices, the S series for watches, security T-chips, and some Macs, W, etc. On an infinite timescale, writes Cameron, in which Apple puts ARM chips into Macs, what letter should the chip series get? So to recap, A is system on a chip. A is the iOS system on a chip. S is for the watch. W is the Bluetooth Wi-Fi system on a chip. T is the Mac security system on a chip. And there's also M, which is the motion coprocessor. So, John Siracusa, what would the Apple designed Mac CPU, what letter would that have?
It's easy. The answer is A.
Really?
Yep. It'll be A and a bigger number. Boom. Done. Guaranteed.
I did not see that coming. Really? That confident? Mm-hmm. I was going to go with R or S, which is partially influenced by our chat over the last few days.
And the car thing, yeah. The Mac Pro GT2 RS.
Yeah, I guess it would be R then, because S is taken.
GT2 RS. I was using Porsche.
I'm with you. I'm re-looking at my list I put in the show.
Now I'm saying Porsche like Marco. See what's happening to me?
We've ruined you, John. Marco, what letter are they going to use?
So I thought about this. At first, I thought that X would be kind of cool. Not only because it would introduce...
I think you mean 10.
I was going to say, it would introduce all sorts of horrible pronunciation jokes. Like, imagine if it was like the X1X, and it's like one of... Like, it's pronounced X110. But like, so one thing to consider, though, with this lettering is that Mac chip names need to represent a much wider range of capability at any given time than the iOS, like, A series. Like, iOS devices all have basically the same power budget. The phone gets, you know, like the A12, right? And then the iPad has the A12X. But the A12X is the same chip as the A12 for the most part. Sometimes it's like a little bit higher clocked. One year it had one more core. It had 3 instead of 2. But for the most part, the main difference is that the X versions have more GPU bandwidth, and because they're driving way more pixels. But for the most part, those are like basically the same chip. But in Macs, you have a huge variety of basically thermal classes. You have like the little 5-watt chips that are in the 12-inch, all the way up to the like 180 or 200-watt chip in the iMac Pro, and you have all sorts of models in between. So you need there's gonna need to be more than just like every year. Like, you can't just have like the A12 and the A12X cover the entire range of Macs. Like, that's not enough to denote the differences. Even if they are very different, like, you would still want more letters to denote that. And so I didn't want to pick X as the first letter, because I think we're going to need that as one of the suffixes for like the pro version of the chip. So you want like, you know, the something 10X to be like maybe the pro version that's in the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro.
Apple hasn't used Z. You could put a Z at the end for a speed suffix.
And then you're also going to probably need more letter suffixes for like some of the other ones. Like, I thought like maybe like a C or an L for the super low power one, because C is used in cheap cars and L is for low power. And then like
the Mac LC, Celeron, all sorts of great things going on.
the iPhone 5C, right? That's a thing. So you know, C for like the cheap one, basically, or like the low power one. And then like no modifier for like the middle one, that's like the one that's in like the 13-inch laptops and the 4K iMac. Like, the kind of like mid-range, like base model processor gets no suffix. And then maybe for the high end, you have X, And maybe if you need another one in the middle, you use S, because Apple uses S for like the faster one, you know? So I would have, my vote for the first letter is M, even though it's already been used for the motion coprocessor, because A, they don't talk about the motion coprocessor anymore. Like the last time we heard about the M1 chip, I think was when the iPhone 5 came out. Like
M7, right? M7?
Oh yeah, was that it? Yeah, you're right.
They started at 7 there.
Yeah, so we haven't heard about it since. We never heard about an M8. It isn't a separate chip anymore. It's built into the A series system on a chip now. So as far as I know. So it's not a thing anymore. So that's available as far as I'm concerned. It also avoids confusion with the iOS lineup. It avoids most trademarks that might be a problem. Like BMW has the M cars, but that's a totally different industry. It's probably fine for Apple to use it for chips.
Well, all those roads in England.
Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah. But yeah, because I mean, it's like Audi has cars that begin with A and have a number after them, but that hasn't been a problem because it's a totally different industry, right? So, you know, I'm guessing M would be available to use. It avoids, as far as I know, it avoids all of Intel's trademarks. Using X might be a problem with the Intel Xeon. They certainly can't use I. Intel has trademarked on I out the I, and so they they can't go anywhere near that. M is available. It stands for Mac. It also means fast to BMW people. It's a cool letter. It's right in the middle of the alphabet. So my proposal here is you'd have, say, like, you know, for the first generation, you'd have the M1, right? And this is for the low-end laptops and the 4K.
Has to be the 1M because of that really fast Mac that they introduced a while ago.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
And then you'd have like the M1C for the 12-inch, the M1S for the high-end laptops.
As you enumerate this, it's making me think you are perfect for Apple's naming because these are terrible.
I know, yeah. And then the M1X would be in the highest-end 15-inch laptop, the iMac Pro, and the Mac Pro.
You talking about all these things is making me think that I know this question is about what letter would it be, but it's making me think about something that allows me to bring Destiny into the podcast for the second time in 2 weeks.
Oh, no.
Nicely done.
You guys are not familiar with StatCrunch. Do you know what a StatCrunch is?
Nope.
Well, you are familiar with it.
Is that an exercise?
You are familiar with it in a different form because you're familiar with GPU names. So if you, like, the first letter is the first letter, but the idea of having a letter followed by numbers, especially if year over year, like with the A series on the phones, you know, like last year was the A11, this year is the A12. At a certain point, you run into problems. And you're on the A37 versus the 38. You're like, I feel like it's a problem. Like the numbers start getting too big. They become unwieldy. And your note about the range in the Mac line, that you're probably going to need some more numbers there than you need in the iOS line. At the very least, one or two more numbers than you have in the iOS line just because of the range. And if every one of those numbers needs to go up every year or change or whatever, eventually the numbers start to get big and they start to become meaningless because people can't remember the distinctions anymore, right? That happens in GPUs. Look at the ATI, now AMD line, where it was, you know, the Radeon, and then some number. It was like the 1000 series, 2000 series, 3000, 8000, 9000. Once you get around 9000, it's like, are we going to go 10,000? No, you have a stat crunch. Stat crunch in MMO is when you've been giving higher level items that have some stat about them. And like maybe when the game rolls out, like the highest level things are like 100 because it's a cool number. It's like, wow, you have a level 100, whatever, right? But then an expansion comes out and you need to raise the level cap or raise the, you know, the highest level of your items. And it's like 110, 120, 130. Eventually you're up to like 900. Do you want to go to 1,000? It's going to blow your UI. It'll take 4 digits or whatever. So you have a stat crunch, which means that everybody's numbers go down, but nothing gets less powerful. It's just that you change like the scale ratio. So what was before 500 is now 350, but it's exactly the same damage as it always was. We've just done a stat crunch. And AMD did the same thing with its video cards. They restarted the numbering and went to like hundreds instead of thousands and with a different, you know, like because they just get too big. So no matter what they pick on the Mac line, and probably eventually on the iOS line too, they're going to have a stat crunch if they go with the same naming scheme. All that said, my one meta comment about naming is, if we've learned anything from the last several years of Apple naming, is any system that we think we come up with that sounds sensible is probably not what they're going to do, because they always surprise us with something that is just a head scratcher. And it's like, what? Like the only last time they did something that made sense, I still didn't like, which is the tvOS, iOS, macOS like case, but at least that makes sense and it's consistent. But it's bad. But everything else they do is just like 10R, 10S max. So, you know, even though I was so confident in my A series thing, it's, you know, probably more likely that they will be like, no, we're naming them after, like, you know, kinds of bread. Like, wow. I thought you'd do like a naming or something. Like, why the hell are the Mac operating system named after places in California? Because that's what somebody felt like doing. So who knows? Anyway, Casey, what's your guess?
This is the M7 Rye.
I stand by like R, although because of the car connotation, but Marco's convinced me pretty strongly that M has something to it. So I think M or R.
MR2.
Nice.
But not in France.
All right. So let me tell you a short story. On Twitter, it is very popular to make some sort of really cheesy and silly like pun out of your name around Halloween time. And that's all well and good until...
it's not, but go ahead.
Well, right.
Exactly. It's never good.
Well, here's the thing. Then you write into a podcast with a question. And now I'm in the position that I have to read out the following from Michael Goulbriel. Are you rethinking that now, Michael? Anyway, new tech or products often come with regressions necessary, like, you know, LCD or plasma adds latency, or sometimes not necessary, such as the iPhones lose the headphone jacks. What was the last of each Apple product line without regressions you cared about, subjectively better in any way that matters to you? So I guess we can round robin this by platform. So let's start with the iPhone. I have not bought a new phone in a year, but I don't feel like I had any regressions in my iPhone 10. Like, Face ID has always worked pretty darn well for me. I don't feel like I missed Touch ID at all. I feel like my iPhone 10 is pretty much without compromise. Marco, how do you feel about the iPhone line specifically? When was the last time you didn't have a compromise on something new?
Yeah, I think this entire question is not going to go as Michael might have expected.
As long as it's going to be the most recent product in every line.
Almost all of my answers are the most recent model. but yeah, you know, the 10S has no regressions compared to the 10. Now, if you look at the 10 compared to the, you know, 7 before it, maybe Face ID is a regression sometimes in some ways, but overall, like, it's fine, you know, compared to Touch ID, like, it's mostly fine. And so, like, if I look at literally, like, the last product compared to the one before it, like, the 10S compared to the 10 has zero regressions. But even the 10 compared to the 7 has, I think, nothing I really cared about.
John?
Yeah, if I'm not talking about products that I owned, yeah, the 10S has no regressions over the 10. But I would say that the 10 has regressions over the 7. But again, this is for me personally, because I prefer the phone to be a little bit smaller. And so I like the size of the 7 better. And I'm still slightly struggling with, again, not Touch ID versus Face ID, but the home button. So the 7 is the last one that I owned in this line that I felt like had no regressions. The
7 lost the headphone jack.
I thought it, that might have bothered me, but it didn't, you know, it, like, in the end, it didn't. I forgot my dongle once. It only happened once, and it's fine. But yeah, I feel like it's mostly the size. Like, I like the 7 size slightly better than the 10 size, and I would consider that a minor regression. But taking its face value, 10S versus 10, the 10S has no regressions.
For the watch, I still have not bought one. I'm probably going to try to buy one when I go look at the Tenor next week. But I feel like, as excited as I am to try the new one, and from the position of not owning one yet, I think that my Series 3 that's on my wrist as we speak is probably the most recent one without regression, because it added cellular, didn't really give up much on battery life, and is still working great a year on. Whereas I feel like from the moment I buy a Series 4, it's either going to be a hair smaller than I want or a hair bigger than I want. Marco, you don't really believe in the Apple Watch, but nevertheless, what was the last one that did not have regressions?
I almost picked the Series 4. The only reason I didn't is because of software. That not only is the built-in software just a little bit buggy with the new curved screen just still, and they still need to work that out, but I think the curved complications on the old faces, like my favorite utility face, really hurt. That, like, I still have not found a face that I'm happy with on the Series 4 that has analog hands. Like, most of the time I just end up using Solar, which has the digital time and you know, the big sun thing through it. I love the way Solar looks. Even Solar is buggy as hell on this watch, because a lot of times it'll, like, it seems like all the complications will just crash, so they all just disappear, and you can't, and so you just have no complications for a while until you, like, force push and go go to customize and then go back and then they all appear again. So like it's buggy. Like the software is not ready for this watch yet. But if the software was better, I would pick the Series 4 because it is wonderful in so many ways. Because I can't do that yet, though, my official answer right now is the Series 3. It did get thicker than the one before it, but it wasn't by enough that I really cared that much. And it was so much faster than the Series 2 that I thought it was worth it. But yeah, Series 3 had no major downsides. Oh, wait, no. The red dot. That's a big one.
Oh, why did you ruin it?
And it was thicker.
Oh, God. Okay, Series 2, I guess, would be the... Like, again, really, I should be picking the Series 4 because I am very happy with it, but I really wish the software was a little bit tweaked on it. So it's probably the Series 4 in reality, but if I'm being a real stickler, it'll be then the Series 2.
Yeah, see, I think the dot is a bummer, but I don't think it's enough that it actively bothered me to consider it a regression in the spirit of the question. So I stick
it's real bad.
I stick by Series 3 for me. John, do you have any thoughts on this?
I would pick the Series 4 because the things that Marco mentioned, I don't care about. Like, I'm not so picky about watch faces. Not that I even have one, but I don't care about the curve complications. I'm sure I could find some watch face that's fine. I would just use utility with some whatever. Like, it doesn't have any regressions for me. I definitely wouldn't pick the 3 because of the thickness. And so I would have to go back to the 2 before. But I think the 4 is, it does not have any regressions that I care about.
iPad, the last one that I bought, and the last one without, I think, any compromises to me, was my iPad mini that I feel like I got 13 years ago because
that about? Is what regressions did the iPad Pro 9.7 have?
I don't want a 9.7 inch iPad.
That's not a regression though.
It's from me. From subjectively
better. No, regression from the previous model of the iPad 9.7.
The regression is he doesn't own it.
No.
That's why it's worse.
It's like saying the 12.9 inch iPad is a regression from the mini because it's too big.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying.
That doesn't make any sense.
I want an iPad, and actually, I don't really get to this earlier, but I think that even though I never touch my iPad mini anymore, in part because it's so darn old, I actually think that there's a pretty good shot I'm going to buy an iPad after this event because I'm really interested in what's being shown. But anyway, up until Tuesday, I don't feel like I want a full-size iPad anymore. I did that, and I don't want it anymore. I want a mini, and the most recent mini was the best iPad for me. It's just ancient now, and so any of the other ones, yeah, they're not a regression in terms of, like, you know, year over year, the 9.7 from one year is better than 9.7 the prior year, and the 10 was better than the 9.7, etc. But for me, as the question says, subjectively better in every way that matters to
but,
you.
But it says product line. It doesn't say individual product. It's difficult when a product line has, like, the reason I could talk about the 10 versus the 7 is they were essentially replacements for each other. There is no more 7 size. The 10 is the replacement for that. But the 9.7 is not the replacement for the mini any more than the 12.9 is a replacement for the 9.7. Like the iPad line has different sizes. And I feel like you have to pick within those size classes. Just so happens that your size class dead ended, I suppose. But I don't think every new iPad that comes out, you should be saying it's a regression over your mini because it's too big. Like
John, this is my answer. You can answer your own way. This is my answer.
I'm answering the question. I'm answering my own question that I made up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've never done that before and totally rejiggered the rules of a question to suit you. Anyway,
I haven't. I've addressed the question as written and then also said that the question is dumb, but you're saying that you don't want to address the question as. You should give your answer within the rules of this question as well.
I don't even know enough about modern iPads anymore. I would suppose that whatever the most recent 10-inch one is probably. But
sounds
answer.
Like it's got a fingerprint problem.
Well, yeah. Other than the fingerprint, no,
and that's my answer. Like the 10.5 almost made it for me, but because of that fingerprint problem, I have to say the 9.7 Pro that came right before it because that had no downsides. I mean, well, it was more expensive, but otherwise it had no major downsides. And to gain the support of the keyboard and the pencil was massive. Like it was a great all around iPad, great release. And the 10.5 would have beaten it if not for the fingerprint screen.
I don't have enough experience with the 10.5 to know whether it's a regression. So I'm going to pick the 9.7 as well, just because it was great. It was better in all ways than the ones that came before it. Still using it, still love it. I even love the accessories that go with it. Maybe the 10.5 is also, but I, you know, just as good a leap over, but I don't have one, so I can't say.
So I don't have a 9.7 inch iPad, John, or a 10.5 inch or 12 inch. Oh, so
you
I
could have
say.
Given that answer, but you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Moving
you
on.
You said it's because it's too big.
Moving on. For the Mac, I actually think, and this is either going to go over really well or really poorly, and I'm not sure which direction. I actually
Is it the Mac Mini?
No. I think that my most recent 15-inch MacBook Pro with anti-glare with an SSD in it, which I don't remember if it came from the factory that way, so I'm kind of cheating a little bit, and I admit it.
It didn't.
But okay, so the 10.5 high-res anti-glare, especially once an SSD went in it, was probably the least amount of compromise of any of the Macs I've ever owned. And that, even though I love both my 5K and my adorable, I think there are some amount of compromise in both of those machines. And I think that the 15-inch high-res anti-glare was with the least amount of compromise. And that's the one that I remember most fondly.
So I have it split between desktop and laptop. Desktop, obviously, the iMac Pro. Like, as I said earlier, it's fantastic. There's nothing about it that's worse than anything that came before it. And it's better. It wins on every front, whether I'm comparing it to the 5K iMac or the trash can Mac Pro, which I think you could argue it's a, you know, successor to both of those at the moment. And compared to either of those, on every front, it wins. It is a spectacular product that I'm immensely happy with. In the laptop line, it depends on whether you're talking about years or generations. If you're talking about years, technically, the 2018 MacBook Pro, all the horrible things about it were already horrible in 2017. So they're either the same now or better. So technically, the 2018 MacBook Pro would be my laptop pick. If we're talking generations, though, which I think is more interesting, I would say the Retina MacBook Pro. That's the generation that went from 2012 to 2015. That generation, I think, was that's the one I wrote the best laptop ever article about. Like, it's such a awesome generation of laptop. As much as I love the 2010 MacBook Air, this is more recent. And so it did lose the optical drive, and it did lose upgradable RAM and disks, but those didn't really affect me. Even back in 2012, when I got the very first one, those didn't really affect me. So the 2012 Retina MacBook Pro is my laptop answer.
I will continue to follow the instructions of the question and say the product line being Mac, and I pick the iMac Pro because I'm taking the Mac. I hate all laptops anyway. iMac Pro. Easy answer.
All right. Finally, the Apple TV. I don't personally have any need for 4K because I don't have a 4K TV. So the third generation where it got the whole new interface and all that? I don't mind the remote. Everyone's going to yell at me. I don't mind the remote. The remote is fine for me. I don't feel like it's a compromise. I like it. It's fine. So for me, the third generation Apple TV is the one with the least amount of compromise. Marco.
I go with the Apple TV 4K. I think you should get the Apple TV 4K, even though you don't think you need it, because it is significantly faster and more responsive and, in my experience, more reliable. I maintain at any given time between 2 and 4 Apple TVs, depending on like beach stuff or my in-laws or something like that. Like, I'm always like, we always buy Apple TVs for everybody for various Christmases and everything, and so like I have like a small fleet of them basically. And the first one with the Siri remote, which I believe was the fourth gen, maybe
I thought it was third. Is it fourth?
I think it's fourth. Anyway,
okay, my bad.
That one, the one that runs TVOS, the first generation of those not only gets really slow at really weird times and is unresponsive for weird reasons more often, but I've had them flake out. I mean, they are older, but I've had them flake out and die in weird ways and just be generally unreliable. Whereas the 4K ones, again, while they are younger, so far have been rock solid and are way faster and way more responsive to input and touch and everything else. So the 4K actually is really good. And I think the original fourth gen had a major regression in the design of the remote. But again, the 4K didn't get worse. It actually got slightly better with that stupid white circle they put around the menu button. So it is slightly less horrible. And everything else about it is better. So Apple TV 4K is my pick for this.
Me too. Apple TV 4K. Everything Marco said.
All right. And then finally, Fabian Deem writes, are you using the Shortcuts app at all? And if so, what are your favorite uses or shortcuts? I actually have kind of gotten back into workflow/shortcuts since Shortcuts came out. My favorite one is a slightly revised version of what I call ETA to Aaron. So what I can do is I can say, hey, Dingus, I'm on my way home. and it will figure out where I am, figure out how long it takes me to get home by car. And what's great about Shortcuts Over Workflow is it will actually, without my intervention, send a text to Aaron saying, you know, I'm leaving now, I'll be home in whatever minutes, and that'll be at such and such time. That's my favorite. A couple that I've found are really nice are I have a good night shortcut, which among other things sets my brightness to all the way down, sets the volume of my phone all the way down, turns on Do Not Disturb, but also attempts to SSH into both my laptop and my desktop and turn the volume of them all the way down, because sometimes I'll leave the volume up and then in the middle of the night I'll hear myself get like a text message or something like that. And I don't know why Do Not Disturb wouldn't have caught that. I don't know. Anyways, somehow or another, I sometimes hear audio coming from my computers. And so my shortcut actually will turn their volume down using AppleScript as called via SSH, which is really convenient. And then as an example of something interesting you can do, although this is something that's really only useful for me, is that I use this app called MoneyWell to kind of keep track of our finances. And it doesn't do terribly well when you run it in multiple places at once. It syncs over Dropbox. And as long as you're only ever running it in one spot at a time, you're good. But if you run it concurrently in two different computers, bad things happen. And so I have a script that will log into my desktop, figure out if MoneyWell is running, and then let me know either, you know, you're good to go, or, you know, stop everything. You need to, you know, remote desktop. Oh God, I'm a Windows user. You need to VNC into, you need to VNC into
your screen sharing, Casey.
There you go. You need to screen share with your iMac, tough guy. And you need to, close MoneyWell. And so I use all those, pretty frequently, and I've really enjoyed those. Since I was beating on Marco a lot first last time, let's start with John this time. John, are you using shortcuts at all?
I'm still laughing about MoneyWell, throw your money down a well, TM. I understand the idea is the money is coming out of the well, but I think of MoneyWell, and it's like it's very close to Money Pit. Anyway, sorry, MoneyWell. Sure, the app is great. I have a bunch of shortcuts that I've either tried to make myself or imported from other people. But I have a whole topic on this that's slowly getting buried in our, you know, very long topic list. I think I'll talk about it more later, but shortcuts just don't mesh with the way I want to do things. As a programmer, I find them frustrating. I'm glad they exist, and I'm glad to have shortcuts. Like, for example, based on the last show where we talked about contacts and Apple's rules, suggestions, guidelines about how big your contact photos should be, someone made a shortcut that will run on your phone and it will look at all your contact photos and tell you how many of them are over the limit, right? Oh, which is neat. Cool. And it's like, hey, I'd love to have that shortcut. And he sent it to me and I ran it and it told me I had like 12 pictures that were too big, which is less than I thought I would have, but it's still some. But it's not like I'm a Mac person. I do anything remotely complicated, I do on my Mac. I have some shortcuts that I think might be useful, but it tends not to occur to me to use them. And I just find being productive on iOS devices does not match the way I want to work. So I am not a heavy user of them. I don't have any particular favorites, but I'm still very glad that the functionality is there.
Marco.
Yeah, I'm basically with John. I don't use shortcuts at all. I never used Workflow before it either. I've never gotten into the iOS like automation scene, like with Drafts and Long Center Pro and stuff like that. I just never got into that scene. Whenever I want to do something that involves complex automation, I want a Mac. And that's just, again, it's what I'm used to. It's what I'm good at. It's where all my skills are, or where all my tools are. The kinds of things that our friends who are more into like iOS power usage than me, the kinds of things that they do with shortcuts that they talk about like on podcasts and stuff, I've never, like, all those things that they do are never things that I really want to do. It doesn't really pique my interest, I guess. So I don't do it.
All right.
Thanks for our sponsors this week, Warby Parker, Linode, and Aftershocks. And we'll see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARM, ENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA, Syracuse, it's accidental.
So, Casey, I've heard you've had some drama with, of all things, your waffle maker. What is going on there?
This is sad times. So, I have to set the scene. A year or two ago, maybe even more than that, we dug our waffle maker out from the back of our, like, deepest kitchen cabinet. And we had gotten this waffle maker for our wedding. And we didn't use it, but a couple times for the longest time. And then we fell into the tradition where we would do Sunday morning waffles and bacon. And so Erin, the saint that she is, would prepare homemade waffles and bacon for the family. And these waffles were delicious. There was nothing particularly special about the preparation. I think she uses, you know, a particular kind of Bisquick and mostly follows the direction of the box. I don't need to hear about alternative waffle recipes. That's not the point. But suffice to say, I loved these waffles. They may not have been the best waffles in the entire planet, but I loved them. And one morning, about a month ago, I want to say, I bumped our waffle maker. And I must have done so at either the exact right moment or the exact right way. In retrospect, I should have sent it to Dr. Drang to analyze. But somehow or another, I bumped it, and basically the entire thing fell apart. The plates that were not removable fell away from, like, the iron part, if you will, or the steel part behind the plates. The hinges all but basically exploded. It was as though the thing was a hair's breadth away from falling apart, and me bumping it just put it right over the edge. So I went on a search to find a replacement waffle maker, and the one we had was a Waring WMK300, and I would like for you to not yet look that up. I want you to wait just a moment.
Too late. Wait, too late. That's the one you had? That's the one that I recommended to you, I think. Oh, wait a minute. No, this is...
Is it?
This is $500.
Well, that's the thing. The one that I had did not cost $539.95, which is what this costs on Amazon. This waffle maker was amazing until it exploded. It was amazing. The waffles were fluffy and light on the inside, but always crisp on the outside. It beeped when it was warm enough for you to put in the batter. It beeped again when it was ready, and it cooked the waffles reasonably quickly. Everything about it was pretty much perfect. So,
except for the fact that it makes round waffles.
Don't even start with your square waffle nonsense.
My waffle maker is very similar to this. It's also a Waring. It was only $100, not $500.
Well, we're going to come back to that. But yeah, carry on.
But, like, it's very similar to this. It's a two sided, so it makes two at once, which I think is a critical feature. And it's the kind of like what you see at hotel breakfast bars, where, like, you know, it's round and you pour the batter in and you flip it over, and then you can pour batter into the other side and then flip it over again, and you can make two at once. And just like Casey was saying, it beeps when it's ready. It's crisp. It's a great waffle maker in most ways. There's one major critique I have of it, which is that, at least on mine, the plates are not removable, so it's really a pain in the butt to clean.
Yep. That's absolutely accurate on this one.
I can't believe everyone. I mean, I know everyone cites it because they want you to be familiar with it. It's like, oh, it's like at the hotel breakfast bar, or some people say, oh, it's like in your dorm's, dining hall. Both of which are true, but those are not two things I would ever cite when saying you're interested in fine dining. You know, like a hotel breakfast bar, no, or dorm dining hall. Anyway, I don't like round waffles.
Well, I feel like there might be an argument that you and I should have about that, but let's leave that aside for now.
We will. Don't worry.
So when this was purchased for us, I can assure you it was not $539.95. And although this waffle maker was darn near perfect in my estimation, even still, even as much as I love my waffles, I don't think I would spend $539.95 on this. And so I went digging before the show to find our wedding registry, which I had printed and made a PDF of years ago, 11 years ago when we got married. And sure enough, I found on our Bed Bath & Beyond wedding registry that we had listed this exact waffle maker, which at the time was $80, which is still a lot of money for a waffle maker, but way more reasonable, of course, than $540. And so I ended up replacing this one with, I don't actually have it handy, but some Hamilton Beach model that makes square waffles. And
like an animal.
It is not a, like an animal, Marco. It's so true. And so it makes two square waffles. I will put the link in the show notes. I just don't want to look it up right this second. It makes two square waffles. The thing costs like $30. Hamilton Beach is actually a local firm. They're based out of Richmond. And so I had some amount of affinity for them for that reason. I shouldn't have, because it's just not very good. The waffles are kind of, not gummy isn't the right word, but not the greatest on the inside. And the outside is nowhere near as crispy. It doesn't make any beeps. It takes forever to cook. I don't like it. And so now I don't know what to do, because I am a man that likes myself what Americans describe as a Belgian waffle. I'm not here to debate whether or not that definition is accurate or not, but what that means to an American is a waffle that is very thick, so typically around an inch thick with very deep pockets. That's the way I like my waffles.
There's more to a Belgian waffle than just that.
Well, and yes, but you know, when you're looking for a waffle maker that makes that style of waffle, you're going to look for a Belgian waffle maker. And that's exactly what this is called, a Waring WMK 300, the old one, Belgian waffle maker. And that's what I like. And so what I want, listeners, is I want something that will cook a waffle reasonably quickly, that will give me that nice crisp outside, and then that not too gummy inside. And I'll be the first to tell you, I spent $25 on the replacement. I should have known better, but I didn't know what else to do. And so I tried something, and I'm probably going to end up either donating it or throwing it away or doing something with it, because it's not up to snuff. So I got to figure out what the right answer is. Maybe I need to come and visit Marco and make you guys make me waffles.
No, I don't know why you were asking the listeners, because I already gave you the answer to this question in Slack. I gave you, and I just found out today that there actually is a round one, if you prefer. The round versus square thing you get. But anyway, the waffle maker, I was facing a similar situation. I had a waffle maker that I liked. I like a different style of waffle than Casey, and I was disappointed that I couldn't, because I like a thinner one. I was disappointed that I couldn't find one that made waffles the size and shape that I wanted. But despite that, despite the fact that this makes like 1-inch thick waffles, which are to Casey's taste but not to mine, I'm very impressed with my Breville waffle maker. It does what you expect it to do. But it also has like settings for what kind of waffles you want. You'd be like, isn't there one kind of waffles? And as Casey was saying, no, there isn't just one kind of waffle. Like, the difference between a regular waffle and a Belgian waffle isn't just the size and shape of it. It's also how crispy the outside is versus how fluffy the inside is. Like, you can have a waffle that is kind of the same doneness all the way through, or a thing that's very well done on the outside but not as well done on the inside. Like, there's lots of variations. Plus, there's the overall darkness. And those settings on this waffle maker really actually work. The waffles, you don't need to use any nonstick stuff with it. The waffles come right out. It has a special thing in it that makes it so that if there's any overflow, it doesn't make a mess. You don't, like you're saying, the plates don't come off. Plates don't come off this either. You'll never need it to. There's nothing in this thing you can't clean up by just like pulling it out with your finger. It is absolutely amazing. It makes the waffles fast. It has all the settings you want. It has all the lights and the beeps. And they make a round one, which seems like it doesn't have the Belgian setting. So maybe you want to check it out. But anyway, it makes four waffles at once, not two. Each one is gigantic and thick. And so your waffle maker that you should get, that you will be very happy with, because it makes the kind of waffles that you like, is this Breville, what the hell is the number, stupid Amazon with its mouse over things, it just says the smart four slice waffle maker. I'm sure it has,
but this one is square, you're saying.
All right, so yeah, the round one I will put in. This is the round one. It doesn't seem like it doesn't have the screen, and I'm not sure how many settings it has, but it's the same design basically with the gutter around it and all that other business. They are very big, they are very heavy, and they are ridiculously expensive for waffle makers, but as I thought I might regret getting the one that I got, despite the fact that it makes waffles the wrong shape for my personal preferences, it does a really good job of making the wrong shape waffles.
A glowing review.
Right.
I was impressed by it. I thought I might end up returning this because it was so expensive and I didn't like in the pictures of it, but like it just does a really good, and the settings really do things. Like, that's the thing that blew me away. I'm like, it doesn't matter what the settings are, right? And I changed the setting one day. I was like, what the hell? This is not how I want them. And I realized, oh, I didn't have it set to the setting that I like. Like, you can actually dial in exactly the waffles you make, which most waffle makers don't have. They just have like a light that says, put in waffle now, and then a different light that says your waffles are done. This one has adjustments and, yes, an LCD screen, all sorts of silly stuff.
Mine has a knob that works, and you can adust things. I've actually never seen one that didn't have an adjustment knob.
Right, but no, but the thing this has with the settings is, it's kind of like my toaster has too, like, what is the ratio? Like, do you want it to do, it doesn't do the same temperature the whole side. Like, one of the settings, I think the Belgian one, is basically like, cook it normally until it's cooked through, but then crank it at the end to make the outside extra dark and extra crisp without drying out the inside. Or the regular one, which is keep it kind of the same same slightly higher temperature for the whole time, so it's kind of evenly brown all the way through. Like, those are the type of settings. It's not just like, what temperature do you want me to be? It's like a curve. Like, at what time during the cooking process do you want me to be at what temperature? Kind of like the bagel setting in toasters. If you put the cut side of the bagel face up, we'll, for the last 45 seconds, crank the top element as high as it can go to crisp the top of the bagel without, like, over-crisping, like, the toppings on the bottom or whatever. Like, it's a complicated science. It's not just a dial that says hot or cold.
Yeah, I don't know what this wearing one that I had did, but it worked some sort of magic. Maybe it was temperature, maybe it was something else that got me that just delightful crisp exterior with the light fluffy interior. And I miss it so dearly.
I guarantee you will be able to dial that in on the big four slice one. On the round one, I'm not sure, but the round one is only 122. So,
I mean, and it's worth pointing out here, like, there's a Wirecutter article on Best Waffle Makers.
I looked at it.
While I have my occasional issues with their picks, these do seem reasonable. And actually, is their budget pick at the bottom? Is that the one you got? It looks looks like it matches the description, exactly. But even their top pick is 40. Look, if I made a lot of waffles, I would probably upgrade to their top pick here, because the one thing, I love my waffle maker so much, except washing it sucks so much, that the one thing I would require of any new waffle maker purchase is dishwasher safe removable plates.
I think I got that one and returned it. The one that's on there, that it was like, I don't, like, you think removable plates would be a thing? Again, the plates are not removable on the Breville. I have never washed it. Like, there is nothing to wash. The waffles just come out. You just pick the cooked waffles thing off of the thing and you wipe it. Like, that's it. Like, yeah, there's nothing to do.
I usually will do like cooking spray in there. Are you not doing that?
I am not doing that.
So you're just pouring the batter straight in and it falls
sometimes
out?
Sometimes I put butter on it, depending on my mood, but that gets absorbed by the waffle, so it doesn't remain behind. But you don't have to put anything in it. Nothing. And I would encourage you not to.
Okay, so you're pouring the batter right onto the plate with no lubrication, and you're relying on the nonstick for it to just basically fall off.
Yeah, and as part of the expenses, you're hopefully getting a good nonstick thing. Like recently, my nonstick pans always die, like a skillet or whatever, right? And we bought a cheap one to replace it, which is the quote-unquote ceramic coating, which works great until it doesn't, and it lasts like less than a year. Whatever coating they have on this waffle maker, maybe it's going to go bad and it will be terrible in a few years, but I've had it for at least a year now, maybe more, and it's still going strong.
Interesting.
So I feel like that's what you get out of it. So the one they recommended, the Krups thing, it just felt like like, it was chintzy, and it just didn't, like, it wasn't a quality appliance. And yes, you could take the plates out, but then, like, the heating elements were there, and then gunk got under the heating elements, and then it was not satisfactory in any way. Whereas the Breville one, for all ridiculous cost and everything, it makes better waffles. It makes better waffles than the Krups one does, and it makes less of a mess. It's just a better, obviously, it better be better for, like, three times the price or whatever. But and it's sad because the Krups one, I think, is closer to making the shape and size of waffles that I want. But I think I'll just have to wait for that fad to come around. I wish I could have found, if I could have rebought the one that I had, like, mine just died, like, it doesn't work anymore. But it was older than all my children. Like, this was, it was either for my parents or my grandparents. It was an old waffle thing. It was a Waffle Master or some brand. Some,
that's awesome.
I don't remember what the hell brand it was,
Master.
It wasn't Waffle Master, it was something else. But I looked for it online and it didn't exist. And I looked for it on eBay and I couldn't find it. So I'm like, all right, I would have just rebought it because it gave me what I wanted.
Well, and it's funny you bring that up, because I may have found one spot online that might have a few of these left. And when we're both awake tomorrow, I pretty much plan to plead with Aaron, hey, can we spend $80 on a replacement for our old waffle maker? Because this thing, while it was working, was flawless. But yeah, I saw the Wirecutter post. I looked at it a lot. The thing that gave me pause was it was hard to tell, both from the Wirecutter and from the Amazon reviews, which are always hit and miss to begin with, whether or not the waffles were thick as I wanted. Plus, I don't want a square waffle. We can have this fight, but I honestly don't have a lot to back myself up. I just think that square waffles are not as good, like not in a taste perspective, just in an aesthetic.
This is kind of like the Midwest pizza thing where they take a round pizza and they cut it into squares. It's disharmony, right? The square the things in a waffle, the little holes, they're square, right? And the second thing that really bothers me is if you're going to have a round waffle, the only way I will accept a round waffle is if it is one waffle. I don't want a round waffle that then cut into four things. So it looks like what I'm getting is instead of getting four waffles, I'm getting 4 3-quarter waffles.
Oh, no, John. Right? No,
not complete waffles. It's like, so I had a waffle here, right? And then someone ate the around the edge and I'm missing that part of it.
So, but I came into this conversation expecting to totally fight you on this, but I think you're convincing me that that round actually is not what I wanted.
No.
All right, here's the thing we can agree on. That waffles, no matter size and shape, they all taste good. And like, you know, in general, like a round waffle, I'll take a round waffle over a no waffle. Like we can all agree on that. Waffles are universal good and we should accept them into our hearts and just eat them. But if given a choice.
Oh, and by the way, Casey, on the recipe side, mix some fast action yeast into some warmed but not too hot, like in the microwave, milk. Like whatever milk you're going to use to make the batter, like warm up the microwave for like, I don't know, 30 seconds. Like make it just warm, like lukewarm to the touch. Dump in a packet of fast action yeast. Stir it up. Dump it into the batter. Make the batter. Put plastic wrap over it for 20 minutes. Come back. You have a very light, airy batter.
Man, you give me far too much credit with regard to my patience, but I appreciate the tip.
You can also just make them
it's
yourself.
20 like minutes. It's not that big of a deal.
You can make. You don't need to use a mix. You can just make it yourself. Like most waffle makers will come with the recipe. The recipe is very wildly. I will warn you. Like you might want to just look one up or whatever. But if you are going to use a mix, I'm going to put a shout out for Aunt Jemima over Bisquick.
Really? I don't think I've tried that.
Yeah. It's what I grew up with. I've had Bisquick as well because that was my wife's brand, but we've converted. I've converted her over to thing. If you like Bisquick and that's what you expect, you're going to continue to like it. But Aunt Jemima is more to my taste, and the fact that I was able to convert my wife's show is something to recommend. But homemade tastes better unless you have a bad recipe. Like I used to make the homemade ones for my kids, and they eventually told me like I would do the blind test, like which one do you like better. They like the mix better because I've been giving it to them for too long. So the homemade ones that I painstakingly made. For them, they, you know, I think it's probably a tie because I haven't found a really good recipe, but the convenience of the mix just wins out.
Yeah, well, and we're, to be more specific, we're using the Bisquick Heart Smart mix, which is, I think, almost maybe a little bit better for you, but
let's be honest, your heart doesn't like any part of eating waffles. Like,
right, exactly.
You're attacking the wrong problem if you're subbing out a different waffle mix for oh,
agreed,
heart health.
Agreed. Well, and also let me remind you that it's not just waffles on Sunday mornings, kids.
Bacon,
it's waffles and bacon. So I'm. It doesn't really ultimately matter.
My one tip for the mix thing, by the way, this will work with Bisquick as well as anything else. Maybe you can say this is just for kids. The kids do love it, but I think grown-ups like it too. Put a tiny little bit of vanilla extract into your waffle mix.
Aaron does that. I'm almost sure.
It's not in the recipe, but I just want to make sure people do that.
Yeah, I always use a little bit of vanilla. I use one more egg than they ask me to.
I wouldn't go that far.
And I do the yeast trick if I have time and a little bit of baking soda if I don't.
The yeast trick makes me think that's a thing that a beer drinker would like. Like, make everything yeasty.
No, it gives you good more point. Air bubbles, basically, which I like.
Yeah, I know what you're going for, but, like, yeah. And it's also, like, the sort of the malted waffle type things, again, dorm dining halls and stuff like that, that it was never to my taste, but some people really like that.
All right, so one way or another, I need to find myself something better than this Hamilton Beach abomination.
And someone brings up in the chat room, I'm almost afraid to talk to you about this, Casey, but I really feel like we need to have this intervention.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Please use maple syrup on your waffles. Please, please tell me that you do. Please.
Oh, God. What is it that we use? Hold on. Let me open any list.
Oh, no. That's not good.
No, there's not. It's either maple syrup or it's not maple syrup. There's
No, it's not. It's something.
Oh, God.
No, come on, Casey. What are you doing? You're making these waffles. You're right about how good they are, and then you're ruining them. You have to use maple. You have to.
You're pouring corn syrup on them?
You have to use maple syrup.
We use Log Cabin Light with no high fructose corn syrup.
No, you're pouring corn syrup on your waffles, please.
With no high fructose corn syrup.
Now we know what to get Casey for Christmas. We are getting you maple syrup. syrup.
Oh my God, Casey.
Stop feeding your children corn syrup.
I've had it. I've had it numerous times. I actually prefer the taste of the packaged crap.
Oh, no, no.
Of course you do. Oh God. I would rather you switch back to a white car.
Velveeta, shells and cheese, and corn syrup.
It says no high fructose corn syrup right on the box or the jar or whatever.
So it's just sugar slime. Please.
Whatever.
You need actual maple syrup, which is nature's sugar slime.
No, I am in full agreement. That's look, it's fine if you can't afford maple syrup. It is more expensive. A bottle of it's like $12. You can afford
it's like,
it.
It's like real Parmesan cheese. Like you can have less of it and have it less often, but have it be good. Like
if you're drinking enough maple syrup that the price is a problem, you're probably drinking too much maple syrup.
Yeah, I mean, exactly how much are you going through? Like, yeah. If you have a family of 17, I can see the economic argument. And also, there's such a thing as sales and coupons. Like, it doesn't really go bad. It's pretty shelf stable. So if you are just a little bit smart about finding it, you can get yourself maple syrup for not that much money. And it's so worth it. So worth it.
I love that I've trained you two so well that you assume it's a money issue. It's not. I'll spend the money if it's worth it.
No, I assume it's a South issue. Because you're so far from fall in New England that you just don't know how to do waffles.
You realize like when Mike comes to visit the U.S., he goes back with maple syrup. Like, he brings maple syrup to England because that's hard to get there. Like,
no, I'm not arguing that it is.
That's how good it is.
Yeah, no, I'm not arguing that by almost any measure it is superior. It's just my taste buds, as screwed up as they may be, I like
It's the same. It's
exactly.
What you were raised on. I know, but I feel like maple syrup is the kind of thing that even if you were raised on the other thing, you can be converted as an adult. It is possible. You're not. You can get to the point where you are not craving the other thing. Shells and cheese, maybe not. Maybe you'll never be converted off that, but I feel like you can be converted on the maple syrup. You can come around. And certainly, I'm saying for your children. For your children, Casey. Don't get them started.
Create a better
path.
Future for your children.
Exactly.
Whenever we go to my parents and stay overnight, which happens, you know, once every few months, typically Dad will make pancakes and he will warm up some honest-to-goodness maple syrup and he'll warm up some sugary sludge. And every single time I reach for the sugary sludge, I am aware of what maple syrup tastes like. I've had it many times in my life. I don't find it to be superior.
Yeah, you should try it cold. If you don't like
cold?
It warmed up. Yeah. Refrigerator cold.
I thought you just meant like room temperature.
Refrigerator cold. I mean, warmed up is definitely a thing. Room temperature is a thing, but try it cold.
Yeah, I actually prefer it cold. I like pouring cold maple syrup on a hot waffle like that. Mm-hmm. I know it doesn't make sense. I mean, waffles only stay hot for like 2 seconds anyway. So, you know. I kind of like the temperature contrast.
There's also the divide of pour over versus a puddle next to and dipping.
Oh, you have to pour over.
Well, I pour over, but I kind of overshoot the waffle a little bit so that I have edges that I can dip into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're doing a hybrid, yeah.
A hybrid. Oh, and to go back to the circle conversation, part of the reason I like the circles is because
you can fill the whole plate.
Well, that too. Part of the reason I like the circle waffles is because what ends up happening is the first waffle, the when we were using circles or when we had circles, was I would give a quarter to Declan and I would have the remaining 3/4 for myself. And then subsequent to that, I could take half waffle or quarter waffle. So typically I would do a 3-2-1. I would do 3/4 of a waffle, half a waffle, and then 1/4 of a waffle. And at that point, pretty much every single Sunday morning, I knew that I was full. And I liked having that time to space it out and eat slowly and enjoy my waffles. And you can't do that easily with a square waffle. You're just going to be hacking at that thing.
See, the thing is, your kids are going to grow up and you have a 4-person family. And if you make 4 waffles at a time, it's very convenient.
Yeah.
4 full waffles.
That I totally understand. But that has nothing to do
with... Ready for the next batch? 1 for everybody.
But that has nothing to do with shape. That's just the particular model that
The circle is not an efficient use of a... Anyway, we've already gone through the shape thing.
So I'm a little curious, because I struggle with this. What is your buttering strategy? Because like, the problems I have with waffle buttering are, mm-hmm. A, like, you could make an argument that you actually kind of don't need the butter, but no, I like false. It better. You could not I make think that it's argument. Well,
sometimes waffles are just a butter delivery device.
Yeah, like I think they're way better with butter. But
absolutely.
I have two challenges when trying to butter my waffles. Number one is the aforementioned heat capacity of a waffle is very low, or the specific heat rather of a waffle is very low, where it loses heat real fast, like faster than eggs. Like waffles stay hot for 2 seconds and they're cold. So you have a very small window in which to butter it before it's too cold to even melt the butter and then unpleasant to eat. And then also, the shape of a waffle is such that it's hard to spread butter through
it's like going to pool in one of the holes and you're not going to get any butter.
Right,
else.
Right. So how... Casey, you're hopeless. John, how do you butter a waffle effectively?
Oh, well, come on. So, I didn't even have a chance. So I have a secret.
Casey probably just sprays on margarine. But John,
he sprays on
that, there was a window of time in my life where I did use... there was a window of time in my life where I did use spray-on butter, but this is not that window of time.
Of course there was.
No, the correct answer to this question... We don't even need John.
Butter, air quotes.
Yeah, right?
We don't even need John to answer.
Like, I'm already using Kerrygold, which is great. Like, Kerrygold, because it's softer, it's grass-fed, it's wonderful, it's great butter.
Are you using the spreading tub kind?
Sometimes, not every time,
because that is softer than the sticks. We also have Kerrygold most of the time.
So the correct answer to this question, which is something that Americans find barbaric, is to leave butter out and do not refrigerate it, so it is not rock hard.
Rejected.
And then it is so much easier to spread. And
especially
that is
when it gets that
do.
Hard crust on it, and the mouse is nibbled on the corner. It's great.
Oh my god! Stop it, you. I'm not. It's not like I'm leaving it sitting like just out there on the counter. It's covered. It's just the point is it's room temperature. Well,
what Casey's buying is not real butter, so no animal wants it.
No, we are buying real butter, you big jerks. It just trust me on this. Try leaving a little bit of butter sitting out for a while.
That's not. I mean, you don't have to do that to get that solution. But there's a market question. There's two parts of it. One, you can even with the non-stick things, like I said, that you don't need to do any lubrication. You can put a pat of butter down on each thing for flavor, not for non-stickiness, and it will sort of butter infuse the waffles. Depending on if you're making homemade, depending on the recipe, lots of the recipes have melted butter in them. Sometimes too much melted butter. So you can balance the butteriness before you even get it to your plate and start considering putting butter on top of it, because if the waffle itself is more buttery, you're less reliant on getting butter evenly smeared. And then for the spreading of the butter on, I have one technique that's gross that Casey might like, and then I have like the basic thing. The basic thing is, like, if you just leave the butter out while you're cooking and preparing it, it will be soft enough. And the Kerrygold tub stuff is softer than the sticks, so you can basically do the thing that you should never do with the stick. If you do this with a stick, you should feel bad, where you scrape. Do not scrape the stick. Scraping the stick is bad, and you should be punished for scraping someone's butter stick, right? But if you get the tub is meant for scraping. So if you get Kerrygold in the tub, which is already softer, you can scrape and end up with these big, like, shaving, like, things. And those can spread very easily because they're already very thin, and you can get lots of coverage. But in the end, you're right, it's not going to spread as easily as it does on a pancake. Whipped butter is a way that you can help with that. I'd rather not have whipped butter on my pancakes. Now, the gross thing that Casey would probably like, maybe this is something I did as a kid. So as a kid on Long Island, they had diners, which is another thing that we have on Long Island, or the New York metro area, that they don't have much anywhere else. But we had diners, and we'd go there like every Sunday after church, and we'd eat diner food, which is ridiculously inexpensive, unlimited quantities of breakfast food. And what I would usually get, because I was a teenager and had an unlimited capacity for calories, is I would get I would get a waffle, two fried eggs, bacon, sausage, Canadian bacon, and sometimes one other kind of eggs or a pancake. And what I would do is make a slurry of maple syrup and butter and dip the sausage into that slurry and also dip the pancakes into that slurry. Because then when you're dipping, like, you don't have to worry about, did I spread the butter onto all the thing or did I cool it down too much? You take the waffle that is as warm as it's going to be because you haven't put anything cold on it yet. You take a piece and you dip it into the maple syrup butter slurry, which I admit is gross. But if you haven't had maple syrup butter slurry on breakfast sausage in a diner on Long Island, you are missing out.
Oh, that I'm sure everyone's going to get right on that, John. No, I don't find that to be gross. I find it to be weird, but not gross. But I think part of the fun of having a waffle is the inexact nature of it, in the fact that there's going to be some pockets in the waffle that are just going to be pools of butter and some that are going to be butter free. And it's that the fact that it varies between bites is something that appeals to me. So I understand what you're saying, Marco, that having uniform butter distribution is extremely difficult. But I say you just lean into the fact that it is not uniform and will never be, and just enjoy the randomness.